Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Energy and Climate Finance and Policy Division. We have a quorum. Would Representative Garofalo, would you care to move the minutes?
Happy to move the minutes, Mr. Chairman.
We have minutes from the 19th and the 21st. Representative Garofalo moves those minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are adopted. This morning we'll be walking through the DE language for House File 1833, our Policy and Renewable Development Account Finance Bill. The language is in the packets and posted as a DE1 is in a bill draft format. A DE format has been posted as DE2 with nearly identical language. Today we're not planning to take formal action, just discussing the language and taking public testimony. On Thursday, we'll adopt the DE format and mark up that version. Just about everything in this bill should be familiar to folks in this committee. We've heard these bills through the process of the committee this year. Are there any discussions from members about what's coming up or the process before us? Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just looking at kind of the roadmap for the week, thank you for that brief overview. I want to find out a couple things about when will we want to be able to ask questions from members? Will that wait till after testimony in between? I want to know. We still are waiting to see the process of getting back on the table the amendments that were presented with 1956. There's a lot of amendments still hanging out there that we never got a chance to bring to the table. I kind of want to find out the process of that and just, again, what is the roadmap of this? When do we start diving into the bill? To your wishes.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Today we'll be taking questions on the bill. We'll have a walkthrough of the bill from our House research, and then we'll have questions, opportunities for members to ask questions before we move to general testimony from the public. On Thursday, we'll be going through amendments.
Okay. And a follow-up, Mr. Chair, would that be, again, back to 1956, I see we've got a lot of very good testifiers coming to testify today and tonight. I don't see the PUC on here. And some of us had more questions for somebody from the PUC. Have they been invited or are they planning on attending some of this testimony?
I don't think we've heard from the PUC. It's an open invitation for the public to testify, and they're certainly welcome if they want to come.
Okay. We'll try to do that. Thank you.
And with that,
One more question. And just, when would be the deadlines this week for amendments?
It's 3 p.m. on Wednesday.
3 p.m. Wednesday. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely. Any other questions about the process from here? Seeing no further questions, Representative Wagenius, please present House File 1833.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1833. To be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Chair Wagenius moves House File 1833 to be referred to Ways and Means. Representative Wagenius.
So Minnesota youth see the reality of climate change and know that it threatens their future. They've come from all over the state to tell us they're scared, even terrified. They want us to leave them the same kind of promising future that our parents and our grandparents left to us. That's a tall order, and they know it. They're well aware of the 2018 report of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Their researchers say that the world only has the next dozen years to sharply reduce carbon dioxide emissions to head off the most catastrophic impacts of climate change. Minnesota youth know that adults and our institutions need to make major changes within the next 12 years. The bill before you is a down payment on our effort to give young Minnesotans the kind of future they want and we want for them. I hear folks ask, is it really worth it to make the effort to deal with climate change? After all, we're just a small part of a problem, and not a big part at all. I'm glad this question comes from a very small minority. Minnesotans are a can-do people. Minnesotans know that leadership matters. And especially now that when we hear from scientists like Dr. Mark Seely, he started our first hearing by saying that Minnesota has experienced the most profound changes in the country due to climate change. He said the pace of change is unprecedented and well documented by science. And he said he could not overstate the problem. When Minnesotans set renewable energy standards in 2007, our efforts led the nation. Others followed. Leadership matters. When Governor Walz announced his 100% carbon-free standard, the announcement was reported in the newspapers across the country, from the West in the San Francisco Chronicle, from the South in the Austin Daily Herald, and from the Southeast by the Miami Herald, and by the Associated Press and Bloomberg and more. Our leadership matters. In our hearings, there's been a general acknowledgement that we need to reduce carbon. That's a good place to start. This bill starts with Governor Walz's 100% carbon-free standard by 2050. But it doesn't just set a goal. It includes the first round of very practical changes that will put us on the path to a carbon-free future. These are Minnesota can-do changes, changes that Minnesotans would expect of us, solar on schools and in state parks, renewable energy for our higher ed campuses, electric buses, public electric vehicle charging stations in places where one would expect them to be, access to solar for homes and businesses alike. What has been most impressive about our hearings are the Minnesotans who have come forward with the "I want to help" solutions, like the architects who know that they can design more energy efficient buildings so you don't you will find the stretch building code in this bill. Like the builders who want a PACE program that works for them, those provisions are in this bill. And with Governor Walz's proposals that are in the bill, our electric utilities, co-ops, and munis have multiple opportunities to work with Minnesotans on efficiency and on moving from fossil fuels to electric energy. All our electricity providers have a huge role in making sure that young Minnesotans have the kind of future all Minnesotans want for them. This bill provides a roadmap for the changes that Minnesotans of all generations are demanding, changes that ensure the future we want for all Minnesotans, including the youngest. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would hope that our council would go over the bill.
Mr. Aleph, if you could walk us through the bill, that would be greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Section 1 of the bill is from Representative Long's House File 1683. The rest of that bill is on pages 3 to 5, skipping over page 2 for the moment. And what that bill does is set up a process by which customer energy data that's maintained by utilities can be accessed by three different entities. First, the customer themselves. Second, the customer can authorize that a third party receive that data. And finally, it provides a process whereby members of the public can access aggregated energy use data from a utility. Skipping back to page 2, in section 2 of the bill is Representative Long's House File 1022, which modifies Xcel's solar rewards program. It extends the program an additional year and gives some additional money in the remaining years of the program on lines on line 214. Moving Moving to page six. Section 4 actually makes no changes in current law, so that shouldn't even be here. Section 5 at the bottom of the page allows public utilities to petition the Public Utilities Commission to recover costs associated with energy storage pilot projects. At the top of page 8, section 6 allows the commission to, or provides that the commission can allow public utility to recover from ratepayers expenses incurred to employ local workers to construct and maintain generation facilities. Section 7 is from Representative Long's House File 2625, modifying the community solar garden statute. One of the changes is at the top of page 9, which currently subscribers are required to be in the same county or a contiguous county to where the energy generating facility is. The language at the top of page 9 would say that's not necessary if the solar garden has a minimum setback of 100 feet from the nearest residential property and the owner or operator of the garden certifies at least 10% of the electric generating capacity of that garden will be reserved for residential members. Another change made is on page 10, in the middle of the page, subdivision 4, which establishes the Department of Commerce as the agency that will administer the Solar Community Garden Program. Up till now, it's been administered through Excel itself. This bill also creates two new types of community solar gardens. One is at page 11 in subdivision 6, a community access project, which is defined as a community solar garden in which at least 50% of the generating capacity is subscribed by residential customers. At the very bottom of the page on the last line, it provides that those community access projects, in those community access projects, the public utility will purchase the energy generated at the retail rate. A second new type of solar community garden project is created in Section 8 on page 13. And these gardens consist 100% of residential residents who currently receive LIHEAP assistance. This is a federal program, stands for Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program. And another requirement of, or way to be eligible for a LIHEAP Community Solar Garden Program is that the garden must be managed and operated by a community action agency or an organization such as an Indian tribe that has been, that contracts with the Department of Commerce to disperse LIHEAP funds. Turning to page 14, section 9 also talks about rate recovery for certain investments by utilities and just specifies that the rate of recovery should be net of revenues on line 14.20. Section 10 on page 15 again provides that expenses incurred by a utility are to include employment of local workers to construct and maintain generation facilities. Those costs are recoverable. Section 11 on page 15, moving over to page 16, adds a definition of carbon-free to the definitions under the Renewable Energy Standard, lines 16.8 and 16.9. Section 12 also amends the Renewable Energy Standard by adding some language to the provision allowing for a for a utility to request from the PUC to modify or delay the standard. The new language on lines 18 and 19 on page 16 specify that one of the things the commission must consider in evaluating such a request is the environmental costs that would be incurred as a result of that delay or modification. Also on the top of page 17, is new language. Another condition that the commission is required to examine when it's considering a request for delay or modification is if there are transmission capacity constraints. And the new language at the top of page 17 give some additional conditions as to what those constraints could be. At the bottom of page 17 is a new definition that's added to the Renewable Energy Standard statute, of a carbon-free standard requiring that by 2050, 100% of the electricity of each utility should, or 100% of the electricity each utility has as of 2050 should be carbon-free. Section 14 at the top of page 18 is also amending provision in the Renewable Energy Standard. It expands the scope of the local benefits that the PUC should take mind of in implementing this law with respect to high-quality jobs, ensuring that all Minnesotans benefit from clean and renewable energies. At the bottom of that page, in section 15, starting at the top of page 19, requires that each public utility by the 1st of January in 2021 submit an application to the Commission for review and approval of a proposal to install one or more energy storage systems. Turning now to page 20, section 16, Innovative Clean Technologies. I believe this is the first section in here from House File 1956, the Governor's Bill. This says that a public utility can petition the Commission for authorization to invest in a project to deploy one or more innovative clean technologies. And at the top of page 21, it specifies that there's a cap on the amount that can be spent on these clean technologies, up to $5 million each year. Section 17 is also from House File 1956, and you'll see towards the middle of the page on line 19 that one of the changes is that the energy policy of the state to achieve energy savings is increased from the current 1.5% to 2.5%. Section 18 on page 22 begins a long section of this bill, about 25 pages, that are making changes to the state's conservation improvement program. And I think a little background may be helpful here in figuring out what's going on here, because it's a lot of language and it's kind of complex. Right now, the SIP statute is organized by issue. For example, the issue of energy savings goals, the issue of low-income programs. Under each of those subdivisions, there are paragraphs, some of which apply to all types of utilities, some of which apply only to municipal utilities and co-ops, some of which only apply to public utilities. What this language does is reorganize that section. It puts all the language that apply to municipal utilities and cooperative utilities in one section, and all the language that applies to public utilities in another section. So it looks like there's a lot of new language, but a lot of it really isn't new. It's moving existing language from one place to another place in the statute. One thing that is new is you'll see on line 2218, there's a new definition, consumer-owned utility, which means municipal utility or a cooperative electric association. Given the scope of this statute, I'm going to focus only on what is really new language in here, because I think in the issue of brevity, that's probably the best thing to do. And one of the first things we'll notice on page 24, in the definition of low-income programs, it says multifamily buildings of five units or more that are rented by low-income persons are eligible to be served through low-income programs. That's not in current statute, and that's going to play out later in this bill, as you'll see. Turning now to section 19 on page 25, this establishes the energy goals, essentially, for consumer-owned utilities. And there really aren't many changes here, except I bring your attention to lines 23 and 24 on page 25. To be included in achieving the utility's energy savings goals are net energy savings from efficient fuel switching improvements. And there'll be more discussion of that a little bit later in the bill, too. The next really new provision is on the top of page 29. paragraph G, which says that the energy conservation and optimization plan that each customer and utility must file with the commission must have a component focused on improving energy efficiency in schools. And it points out programs to update lighting, update the heating and cooling system, provide for building recommissioning and other things. That is new language. In subdivision 5 below that, we see that low income is defined as 60% of state median income. That is new. And on line 18, it says municipal utility that furnishes gas service must spend at least 0.4% of its most recent three-year average gross operating revenue from residential customers on low-income programs. That's an increase from the current 0.2%. And the same thing is true of the 0.4% number on line 20 that refers to consumer-owned utilities, also going from 0.2 to 0.4. On page 31, subdivision 8 establishes the criteria for efficient fuel switching improvements in terms of when does fuel switching, when is it considered to be efficient and when does it count towards a utility's energy savings goal. The next new language is on page 34 in section 21. This is language that's now applying to public utilities rather than customer-owned utilities. You can see on line 18 that the annual savings goal for public utilities has been increased from 1.5% to 1.75%. The next new language is on page 37, at the top of that page. This again speaks to the issue of fuel switching, and it says that the Commissioner of Commerce must develop and publish technical information that utilities will use to be able to evaluate whether fuel switching improvement meets those criteria that we looked at a few moments ago and will count towards the energy savings goal. So that awaits some technical information coming from the Department of Commerce. On page 39, towards the bottom of the page, paragraph G is essentially identical language regarding the public utilities requirement to include in its conservation plan a component focused on improving energy efficiency in schools. On page 40, in section 26, on line 22, we're adding to existing language that a pre-weatherization measure, it talks about the ownership of the energy conservation improvement and adds talking about ownership of pre-weatherization measures, which are defined a little bit later in the bill. Another new piece of language is at the top of page 41, which indicates that public utilities must spend 0.8% of their gross operating revenue on low-income programs, an increase from the current 0.4%. At the bottom of page 41 and continuing through the first half of page 42 is a long definition of multifamily building, which describes, since they're now eligible to be served by low-income persons, gives a better idea of exactly what buildings fit into that category. Looking towards the middle of that page in paragraph F, lines 42, 18 to 21, is also new language, which specifies that up to 15% of the public utility spending on low-income programs can be spent on pre-weatherization measures. And it also provides a definition as improvements that are necessary to allow energy conservation improvements to be installed in a home. On page 44, in the middle of the page, it's a provision regarding the contract with the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota, and it specifies that of the $500,000 contract, up to an additional $150,000 may be used to provide technical assistance to local jurisdictions which adopt a voluntary stretch code, which we'll be talking about later in this bill. On page 45 in section 29, subdivision 11 speaks to the conditions when in which fuel switching can be approved as contributing to a utility's public utilities energy savings goals. There's also some new language in the middle of page 46 on lines 16 through 18 where it says regarding this the counting of efficient fuel switching improvements towards the energy savings goals, that a utility is not eligible for a financial incentive under this subdivision unless the utility achieves its minimum energy savings goal. On page 47 in section 30, this is the IRP section of the statutes. There are new definitions at the bottom of the page for clean energy resource and carbon-free resource, and also at the top of page 48 for energy storage system. There's also new language at near the top of page 49 in paragraph C of section 31. Currently, as part of an integrated resource plan, utilities are required to include a least cost plan for meeting 50 and 75% of the energy needs from conservation and renewable energy. This language adds another scenario of 100% and specifies it should be a combination of clean energy and carbon-free resources. Section 32 in the middle of the page has new language at the end of that subdivision saying that in evaluating resource options, the Commission must include and consider the environmental cost values that have been adopted under this subdivision. At the bottom of the page, Section 33 establishes a new policy for the state. It says that the favored method for meeting energy demand in this state is a combination of clean energy resources. At the top of page 50 in section 34, this contains the kind of analysis that is required to be done in an integrated resource plan for a non-renewable energy facility. You can see paragraph B includes that same 50, 70, 75, and 100% analysis. Paragraph C also states that in analyzing costs under this subdivision, the utility must include the environmental costs as adopted by the most recent environmental costs as adopted by the Commission. Section 35, beginning in the middle of page 50, adds new language to subdivision 4, preference for now clean energy resources as opposed to renewable energy facilities. It expands the proceedings that these provisions can be applied to include any proceeding in which a utility seeks to construct an electric generating facility or to procure electricity or capacity. And on line 50.25, it specifies that the utility must demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that a renewable energy facility alone in combination with other clean energy resources is not in the public interest. On page 51, new language at the top of the page in paragraph B says in order for the Commission to find that a renewable energy facility is not in the public interest, the Commission must find, again on the basis of clear and convincing evidence, that using renewable or clean energy resources to meet the need for energy cannot be done affordably or reliably. And the rest of that page goes into more detail in terms of what affordability and reliability mean. Also at the bottom of the page, the language requires the Commission to make a written determination of its findings and conclusions regarding affordability and reliability under this section. And also states the Commission must take into account only non-zero values for the environmental costs that are required to be analyzed by utilities. At the top of page 52 in paragraph G is language that states that if the commission approves a resource plan including the retirement of a non-renewable energy facility owned by a public utility, the public utility will own at least an amount of the accredited capacity of clean energy resources equal essentially to the percentage of the retiring facility that remains undepreciated multiplied times the accredited capacity of that retiring facility, and will also own the transmission and other facilities necessary to replace that accredited capacity of the retiring facility under certain conditions which are established in the rest of that paragraph. Section 36 at the bottom of page 52 requires utilities to report as part of their integrated resource plan filing on the associated local job impacts and steps the utility and its suppliers and contractors are taking to maximize the ability of local construction employment. Section 37 also calls on utilities to consider local job impacts when they're approving, when they're going through a bidding process to select resources. Section 38 is new language that establishes that public utilities that file an integrated resource plan must include in that filing an assessment of energy storage systems. At the bottom of page 39, bottom of page 53, in section 39 requires electric utilities to annually report to the commission the cost of their either their own provision of ancillary services or their purchase of those ancillary services from third parties. Section 40 at the bottom of page 54, this is the certificate of need language, and on line 26 it includes energy storage as one of the possible resources that must be looked at under a certificate of need hearing. The same thing is done on page 55 in the middle of the page, adding energy storage systems to that language. Section 41 on page 56 is also language from the certificate of need statute. Again, in the middle of that subdivision on line 12, requires the applicant for a certificate to demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence to the commission that it has conducted that 50-75 100% analysis required earlier. At the bottom of page 56 is language from Representative Long's bill on beneficial electrification. Paragraph A states it's a goal of the state to promote energy and uses powered by electricity that reduce net greenhouse gas emissions. Section 43 is also part of that bill. It requires public utility may submit to the commission a plan to promote energy uses powered by electricity within its service area. Section 44 is from Representative Akam's bill, House File 1133, the Solar for Schools program. This language sets up a grant program to be operated by the Department of Commerce to give grants to schools to defray the upfront costs of solar energy systems that would be installed on or adjacent to school buildings. And talks about the application process on page 59. Also specifies at the bottom of page 60 that no more than 50% of the grant payments awarded to schools can go to schools where the proportion of students eligible for free and reduced price lunches is less than 50%, and applications cannot be submitted after December 31st, 2023 at the bottom of, or at the top of page 61. Section 45, also on page 61, has a similar program for Solar for Schools, but this is a program specifically for schools located in the XL Energy Retail Electricity Territory. And rather than a grant, this is using, this is sharing, the solar energy systems are to be owned by third parties who will share some of their tax and other financial benefits with the schools, and that will be added to from funds from the renewable energy or from the renewable development account for the schools. Turning now to page 64, section 46 is from Representative Long's House File 2233, which establishes a program to award rebates to purchasers of electric vehicles. At the very bottom of the page, it says a $2,500 rebate is issued for new vehicles, and at the top of page 65, a $500 rebate for a used electric vehicle. Rebates cannot be issued for vehicles whose manufacturer suggested retail price exceeds $60,000. Section 47 in the middle of page 65 is also from House File 2233. It's a grant program which is to defray the cost of installing public electric vehicle charging stations in state parks and at park and ride facilities. Page 66, section 48 is from Representative Long's bill regarding the commercial PACE program. What it does on line 6618 is amend the definition of cost-effective improvements to include new construction. And in section 49 on page 67, it establishes that qualified commercial real property also includes new construction. And what section 50 does is add a measurement of the property's real property's appraised value as a portion of that as a potential cap on the size of a loan. Subdivision 10 or section 51 at the bottom of page 67 is also part of that CPACE bill that states that cost-effective energy improvements under this bill are deemed to be real property, which I believe means they are taxable. On page 68, section 52, in the middle of the page, is new language that allows the Public Utilities Commission, when it's issuing a permit for a wind facility greater than 25 megawatts, to require contractors and subcontractors on the project to pay prevailing wage. It also says when the commission is issuing a site permit to modify, or I'm sorry, for a large wind energy repowering project, it can apply that same requirement. Section 53, beginning on page 68 and extending to page 69, essentially establishes that same possibility for counties that are issuing permits for wind energy facilities and repowering projects, again, with respect to prevailing wage. Section 54 on page 69 is Representative Long's House File 2396, which calls on the Construction Codes Advisory Council to establish a voluntary code, a voluntary building code set of standards for performance as an appendix to the state building code. That would be voluntary for jurisdictions that could adopt them. Section 55 is Representative Stevenson's bill, House File 1755, that provides money to the Metropolitan Council to purchase electric buses. At the top of page 70, section 56 is Representative Wagenius's House File 1191, which calls on the Public Utilities Commission to establish a new incentive for utilities that after they reach their 1.75% electric energy sales savings goal, that they continue to do residential conservation under this new incentive that the commission will develop. Section 57, in the middle of page 70, is Representative Stevenson's House File 2618, awarded as a pilot project for electric school bus demonstration. Turning now to section 58 at the top of page 73, requires the Commission of Commerce to do a report to the legislature which develops benchmarks and strategies designed to significantly accelerate the reduction in greenhouse gases by 2030. Section 59 at the bottom of that page is Representative Carlson's House File 2126, the Prairie Island Renewable Energy Project. Section 60 on page 74 requires utilities to participate in a coordinated engineering study to identify needs of the transmission network in the event that large energy generation resources are retired. Section 61, beginning at the bottom of page 74, is the appropriation section. Most of these refer to provisions I've discussed earlier, except subdivisions 1 and 2, which are new. Subdivision 1 awards $6 million to the University of Minnesota to accelerate a transition to renewable energies. Subdivision 2 awards the same amount to the Minnesota State Colleges and University System. Finally, the last section in the bill, section 62 on page 78, is repealers. These are all repealers of subdivisions that are in the current SIP law. Subdivision 1 are the current definitions, which, as you saw, have been changed and added back into their respective provisions, depending on what kind of utilities they refer to. Section 2C is subdivision 2C is a subdivision that expired in 2008. Subdivision 4 specified if there were any federal prohibitions against utilities investing in conservation that the state try to waive those prohibitions. That's language that's no longer necessary. And finally, Subdivision 5 was a subdivision that had utilities encourage people to use fluorescent light bulbs and develop a collection system for them, which is also no longer needed. That concludes my walk.
Thank you, Mr. Yeoff. That was extremely helpful. So we'll go to member questions, and then we'll take public testimony. We have a large number of public testifiers signed up. If we don't get through them in this morning's meeting, then we'll recess and reconvene at 4:30 back in this room. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Yeoff. Very well done to explain a lot of these things. I just have one question for now. Back on page 16, line 14, we're talking about kind of a modification or delay when requested. My question might be, as it's read, the commission, when requested to modify or delay implementation of a standard, must consider, and then number 2 is highlighted, the environmental cost, .. If we're talking about the 100% clean carbon-free stuff, who can actually request a delay? This isn't a change to requesting a delay, but would that be a customer or a utility? Just help me understand who would be able to request a delay.
Mr. Ulett.
Mr. Chair and Representative Baker, it's my understanding that the utilities would make that request.
So they just, Mr. Ulett, Mr. Chair, they would just go in front and request it. It's I guess it's just part of the hearing process, the testimony. They would just raise a note, and they would be able to request that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, that's correct, and this subdivision describes what the commission has to take into account in weighing that request.
And finally, Mr. Chair and Mr. Yeoff, if that were to proceed, then they request a delay, and then it goes into effect, and then rates go up. How does a request then, or a delay, or a process work to sort of pull those back? Has that ever been happened where? You know, once things get moving forward and you've kind of gone beyond a certain point, what then does a utility or a ratepayer have for a case to say, stop this, we want to request this again? How does that work?
Mr. Yeoff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, well, if you look at lines 16 and 17 on page 16, the first thing that the commission is requested to consider is the impact on utility costs, and they do that while they're evaluating the request. You're asking what's the recourse once a request has been acceded to, or maybe not, in terms of rates going up. The statutes really don't talk to that.
All right, thank you.
Other member questions before we go to public testimony? Representative Groffel.
Mr. Chairman, did you say that the deadline for amendments is 3 p.m. on Wednesday?
Correct.
How about amendments to the amendment?
We don't have a committee rule for amendments to the amendments.
What do you mean you don't have a committee rule?
We don't have a deadline so 3 p.m. Wednesday would be the same. is when all amendments are due.
Mr. Chairman, if the amendments are due at 3 o'clock, how can you draft amendments to amendments that you don't know exist? You can just give the mic to him, Mr. Chairman. It's all right. It's okay. The staff can speak. It's all right. Just go ahead and talk. It's fine.
Mr. Chair, Representative Graflo, it's an amendment to a DE, so it would be an amendment to an amendment to an amendment, which would be out of order.
So, Mr. Chairman, so my understanding is we would adopt the DE amendment and then take amendments to that. You're telling me we're not going to do that, we're not going to adopt the DE amendment. We're going to take the DE amendment before us and then have amendments drawn to that.
We're planning to adopt the DE amendment on Thursday. And then we're going to be taking amendments to that. So the language, as I mentioned at the beginning, will be essentially the same as this, except it will be drafted as an amendment rather than as a standalone bill.
Thank you.
Yep. Other member questions? All right, seeing none. Chair Wagenius, anything you'd like to say before we move to public testimony? Okay. So our first public testifier is Leah Harrell.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Leah Harrell, and I am a senior at Hopkins High School in the West Metro. Over the past few years, I have witnessed something incredible. I have witnessed the climate movement change the economic, social, and political discussion. I cannot imagine what it feels like for those who have fought for decades to get to this point, but I am honored to have been able to join the fight and experience this very moment, a moment that will define the course of our state's history. I applaud all of you who support the bold initiatives represented in this bill, such as sections 5.8, creating emission reduction goals in line with climate science, and lines 18.2 through 18.24, providing a just transition guidance. I'm grateful to have the privilege to testify in front of this committee more than once in support of these efforts. Yet, I want to make sure all of you understand something very clearly. Speaking into this microphone is not the only form of testimony you all have the responsibility to listen to. Our sit-ins are testimonies. Our school strikes are testimonies. Our lawsuits are testimonies. And most of all, our numbers are testimonies of the values we call you to action. Your generation has the power today to protect my generation's future. My generation has the power to determine who will continue to make these decisions as we become the largest voting bloc in the country. We intend to fill your seats with those who will show real leadership when it comes to addressing climate change and providing a better future for the next generations. I want to leave you with a crucial reminder. Our future is not a political game. I urge you to base your decisions on your morality, on your foresight, and your dedication to the great state of Minnesota. Supporting this bill means supporting our future. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Isaac Orr is up next. And on deck after Isaac is Brian Novak. Oh, excuse me. Representative Baker, did you have a question for the testifier?
No, but as they come up, that's okay. I just have one question for kind of the group as they come up, as this next one comes up. And I guess to the testifiers, throughout this process, we had, in a large part with Representative Long's bills that were pretty cutting edge, and you can have a seat if you want. I'm just kind of curious, there was a lot of sort of questions asked that had not been asked of the utility operators or some of the folks that had some concerns with the bill. I'm kind of curious, as testifiers come up, if the author has actually reached out to you and sort of, whoever the author was, I don't want to just point out Mr. Chairman today, Mr. Long, Representative Long, but just any others that have actually tried to work with you to make the bill better as this has landed now on our final sort of markup of this bill. Just kind of curious if other folks have had a chance to address that with the authors going forward. So if you have those thoughts, I'd appreciate that if you've been contacted. Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. The main reasons this omnibus will fail to meet its 2050 carbon-free goals and will cause electricity prices to skyrocket is the legislation's reliance on wind, solar, and battery storage, and its failure to legalize new nuclear power plants in the ambiguous future of large hydro and carbon capture technologies to qualify as carbon-free resources in Minnesota. Absent the inclusion of these technologies, this legislation is attempting to reduce greenhouse gas-induced global warming, which the authors have called an existential crisis, using the least reliable, most expensive, and least effective means possible. Battery storage is often heralded as a magical cure for the intermittency of wind and solar, but just 24 hours of battery storage would cost at least $133 billion based on the Tesla battery in South Australia. We would need far more than 24 hours of storage to meet a 100% goal by 2050. Attaining just 50% of our electricity from wind and solar would cost $80.2 billion through 2050, or $1,200 for each Minnesota household every year through 2050. A price tag of $80.2 billion would mean it would cost at least $135 per metric ton of CO2 averted, which is 2 to 8 times more expensive than the social cost of carbon established by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. In contrast, achieving 80% of our electricity by 2030 from carbon-free resources using nuclear power would save Minnesota $22 billion compared to using renewables. If lawmakers truly believe climate change is an existential threat, then Minnesota can't wait to legalize new nuclear, large hydro, carbon capture technologies because these technologies are safe, scalable, and always available. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we have Brian Nowak. And up next is Benjamin Stafford.
Good morning. I'm Brian Novak from Northfield, Minnesota. I'm here to speak about the bill and in support of how it is aligning with the work going on in southern Minnesota for clean energy and equity. At a municipal level, southern Minnesota communities are working on climate action plans. It's going on throughout Minnesota, but in southern Minnesota, the work's going on in Rochester, Faribault, and Northfield, just to mention three. We're at the thick of our work in Northfield and expect the city to adopt its plan in 2020. HF 1833 aligns and complements this work. I'll give you one example. I'm on the Environmental Quality Commission in the city, and 2 weeks ago, Rotary came to our commission asking the city to work with them on a grant proposal to fund 3 EV charging stations in the city. This may seem like a small change, but when the city council adopts this program next week, and it works in concert with the incentives in HF 1833, the change becomes monumental. 1833 is a legislation of vision, possibility, and choice. Imagine a resilient and robust energy grid that serves all Minnesota communities. That means a vision for the farm communities in southern Minnesota. Imagine a private-public partnership resulting from 1833 that funds a group of farms that solely uses electric equipment, tractors, and combines. You might say this is Buck Rogers, but maybe not. John Deere is currently working on a 100-kilowatt tractor as large as the ones that you see in the fields around us in southern Minnesota. Imagine a rural co-op that has multiple 1.5-megawatt turbines that charge a fleet of batteries that are delivered to member farms on a contract basis during planting and harvesting season. When the batteries aren't in use, member farms, they provide a backup needed in rural areas for a robust distributed energy grid. This is one idea of what equity might look like for family farms in greater Minnesota. We need solutions that have vision and equity, not ones that cling to 19th century technology and economic standards. As Representative Wagenius noted, listen carefully to your children and grandchildren about the future they want. This bill goes a long way to get us there. Thank you.
Next up, we have Benjamin Stafford. And on deck is Vishnu Lalitha Surapanini.
Good morning again to all of the committee here. Good morning, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Benjamin Stafford. I'm the Director of Policy and Public Affairs for Clean Energy Economy Minnesota. It's going to come as a total system shock to this entire committee that I'm testifying in support of this bill. We are an industry-led, nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to growing and strengthening Minnesota's clean energy business ecosystem. More simply put, we are the business voice of clean energy in the state. Our membership is comprised of clean energy companies ranging from startup businesses to Fortune 100 companies that employ thousands of Minnesotans across the state, and we are here to support strengthening our state's clean energy business through policy leadership. We thank the committee leadership, including Representative Wagenius, Representative Long, Minority Leet Swazinski, et cetera, Governor Walz, Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, et cetera, for the discussions we've had up to this point. This committee has covered a lot of ground up to this point, and we want to acknowledge that. It's also worth acknowledging that many parts of this bill have had strong bipartisan support in both authorship and across legislative chambers, including changes to consumer data access, supporting energy storage, improving charging for electric vehicles, improving commercial sector clean energy finance options, and fine-tuning energy efficiency programs. These have all had broad participation. This bill supports a transition to a clean, affordable, and reliable energy system while it unleashes economic opportunities across our state, and Minnesota is not alone. There are currently 18 states that have passed, are considering, or including 100% clean energy transition legislation. We are not alone in this, and that is a massive market opportunity. Three-fourths of the Fortune 100 companies have some form of clean energy goal or target. Customers want more control over their energy for a variety of reasons, including controlling their costs and their environmental impacts. Technologies like electric vehicles are increasingly becoming part of our electricity system, as is energy storage. This bill contemplates all of these trends and sets a tone for Minnesota's energy future. In terms of economic impacts, and you've heard me say this many times before, Minnesota is home to over 59,000 plus clean energy jobs, and those jobs are growing two times faster than all other sectors of our state's economy, according to our 2018 Clean Jobs Midwest report. Over the past year alone, renewable energy generation jobs, like those associated with wind, solar, biomass, et cetera, grew 16.5%, which was the highest rate of growth across the entire 12-state Midwest region. Costs of wind and solar dropped 16%, and 23%, respectively, according to a recent analysis by Bloomberg New Energy Finance. And this growth in jobs and downward trends in energy prices are bringing benefits to all corners of our state, is 40% of those clean energy jobs are in greater Minnesota. All of this as Minnesota households enjoy retail electricity bills that are 13% lower than the national average. It should be noted that this omnibus bill also envisions thoughtful transitions for communities linked to legacy energy assets. That's an important part of our state and an important part of the clean energy transition. Pipestone to Pelican Rapids, from Rochester to Duluth, from Uptown to Ely, our state's economy is benefiting from clean energy policy. In closing, policy leadership creates certainty that opens the marketplace for clean energy solutions. With strong, stable clean energy policies, Minnesota will continue to attract jobs and investment. Without them, we will be at a competitive disadvantage. More plainly, accelerating our transition to a clean, affordable, and secure energy system will provide Minnesota with a competitive advantage, will create jobs and spur additional economic opportunities and benefits for all Minnesotans. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Vishnu Lalithi Surapanini, followed by Joyce Pepin.
Good morning. My name is Vishnu Lalitha Surapanini. I'm an internal medicine physician at the university. Back in January, I sat here and talked to you all about the health impacts of climate change. And so it's really exciting for me to be back here, finally talking about the solutions. And there were so many incredible things in this bill, but I wanted to pay special attention to electric transportation and the health benefits of that. now transportation is the number one source of greenhouse gases. So by transforming to electric transportation, we will be making a huge dent in greenhouse gas emissions and limiting the health damages of climate change. There's also water pollution benefits that we don't necessarily hear about all the time. When we have vehicular emissions, they settle down on the roads that then gets washed into our lakes and rivers. And finally, air pollution impacts are what we will see most immediately, because when we change over to electric transportation, we can see an impact in air quality, and this is a real-time benefit of health that we will see. This is not something that's going to be far off. As we know, in Minnesota, about 30% of the people, MPCA says, already live in areas of higher air pollution. And when it comes to lower-income families, that number jumps up to 50%, and communities of color, the number jumps up to 90%. And I'm more than happy to provide any number of references of the health benefits of cutting back down on air pollution. But I kind of wanted to share a personal story with the committee. I've been thinking about the history of climate action as other members before me have testified. You know, way back in like 1912, there was a newspaper article that was talking about how when we burn coal, the carbon dioxide that gets released forms a blanket around the earth and raises earth's temperature. And this was about 20 years before my grandma was born. And then in 1950s, when my mom was born, we knew about climate science, and fossil fuel companies were already trying to come up with alternative theories of delegitimizing that science. In 1980s, when I was born, we had the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, IPCC, that was talking about how we all need to take global climate action. And so I really hope that when my kids' generation is born, they can point to the fact that Minnesota transformed to 100% clean energy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next is Joyce Pepin, and following will be Kent Sulem.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Joyce Pepin, and I represent the Minnesota Rural Electric Association and the many co-ops we serve throughout Minnesota. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on House File 1833. We have several concerns with the bill. I'm going to just highlight, I think, three of them. First, the increased renewable mandates do not take into consideration the limits in existing technology, nor do they provide safeguards to ensure grid reliability and stability if new technologies do not materialize before we ban baseload generation. In fact, the carbon-free standard does not account for reliability at all. No accounting for new technology like carbon capture and sequester. It does not account for the need for gas peaking plants, which serve as an important role during times of need, such as the recent polar vortex. The bill does not provide any safety valve if sufficient technology is not developed to keep the system reliable at an affordable cost. And as a reminder, I mentioned that this last time I was testifying as well, but MISO testified in the Senate Energy Committee, and I'm disappointed that they have not been here yet. They testified that their own renewable integration assessment showed risks to grid stability as renewable energy approaches 40%. Think about that. Risks, great risks, as the renewable energy approaches 40%. To me, that shows this bill is very premature and more work needs to be done to make sure the needs are met. Second, we have concerns with changes to the SIP program. COUs have been meeting for months, even years in some cases, with NGOs to modernize the SIP program. But this bill is not reflective of any agreements the stakeholder groups made. The SIP provisions in this bill are a significant step backward from the status quo. There is another bill that's moving forward in the Senate that addresses the concerns that we have and that we support. Electric co-op suggestions were not taken into consideration at all in this bill, and as a result, electric co-ops do not support the SIP language in this bill. One of the problems is in the SIP provision is the bill retains the spending goal. The stakeholder group agreed to remove the spending goal, as achieving the savings is the point of the SIP program, not spending consumer dollars. Another problem is the bill allows for little flexibility in developing programs over time. Allowing for innovative programs over a longer period of time would allow for more creative offerings. The oversight section also needs a lot of work, as it, in its current provision, calls for more burdensome paperwork and regulations. Finally, we oppose the energy usage data section. This section places utilities in the position of managing the data authorization process with no indemnification. Co-ops already provide access to energy usage data to the account holder, who can then pass that information on to whomever they want. Allowing third parties to gain access to data without customer consent violates trust and risks customer security. How can co-ops or anyone ensure a sophisticated hacker can't unaggregate data when a customer is home or vacationing elsewhere? I'd ask you to consider this. Is this fair to customers? Is this how we want to go? I don't think so. For these reasons and many others, which I'd be happy to talk to you about offline, I'd ask you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Kent Sulem, and then on deck is David Schaefer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. We too have a number of concerns with this bill. We have been very grateful, Representative, that your door has been open to us to have conversations about that. And I'll share some of the other things we've had with various members or groups working on this bill. Picking up where Ms. Peppendrop ended, we have very serious concerns about Section 3 of this bill. And from a municipal perspective, we feel it's unnecessary because we already have the Data Practices Act. We have specific laws and specific procedures on how data is classified and how that data is to be obtained, whether it be by the individual subject to the data or their delegate. To now impose a requirement of aggregating data in a way that most of our folks are saying it doesn't matter, you can still identify the parcels, creating a new process on top of the Data Practices Act and imposing new security requirements on top of what we already have to do as utilities simply is unnecessary and very problematic and would not result in any benefit to the public. We have concerns with the 100% carbon-free, not because it's a bad aspiration, but because there are certain times that you have things like the backup generators that are used for peak loads that simply it would not be economically viable to try to switch out all of that. You're going to have them used. Sometimes it's a couple hours a day. Sometimes it's for maybe 2 days in a row, and then they're off. And to try to go through and do everything that would make them 100% carbon free simply is not in the best interest of the use of funds. We are working with the department on identifying some alternatives for that process. We too have problems with the SIP concerns. I will not duplicate the comments made, but simply would encourage that we look at the alternative in the other body. Finally, I will try to end on an up note, and I'm glad that Mr. Schaefer is following me because that's just the one area that we are very happy to report. We have an agreement on the solar on school programs is something that I think will be a positive for us to work on in the format that it was finally incorporated, and we do appreciate that the outreach that we had with Mincia. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Next, we have David Schaefer, and then on deck is Annie Levinson-Falk.
Mr. Chair, my name is David Schaefer with the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. First off, I just want to say thank you to you all for bringing this delete all amendment and for listening to the concerns of the industry. The next point I'll make is to piggyback off what Kent said and to answer Representative Baker's question. After that first hearing on the Solar on Schools bill, we heard several concerns, and so NCO worked with the chair, Representative Acomb, and several other members of this committee, as well as several utility stakeholders, the electrical unions, the Department of Commerce, and the School Boards Association to try to draft a better bill that everyone could get behind. And I think as of yesterday, we were able to button it up and get the language in that you see before you on page 57. To the contents of the rest of this bill, we believe that by mid-2020s, the utility-scale solar will be the cheapest form of energy in Minnesota. What this bill does that's most important is it bridges the gap between today and that time period. If we were to just suddenly have the cheapest form of energy in this state and then try to build that out, we'd be hiring labor from other states. We wouldn't have the expertise here. But this bill helps us grow our labor force by developing the community solar garden program, allowing for greater expansion of size, the contiguous county change, and additions to the residential program. It allows for expansion to the solar rewards program, as well as a nice tweak from direct current to alternating current that aligns statutes through with the net metering statute and solar rewards. It provides great funding for solar on schools and solar in parks to make sure that developers have some experience with rooftop arrays as well as ground mount arrays. And it also provides some great energy storage language that we're very excited about, the language that came out of the Senate and that came out of the House. We believe would be a great package for taking our first steps towards storage in this state. So with all of those components in this bill, we wholeheartedly endorse it and are very excited about what's to come over the next few years. Lastly, I'll just end with, not only is this bill a bridge from today to the utility scale market of the future, but it also sets our guideposts for even further down the road when we want to have a carbon-free world, and this is just a great map for that as well. So thank you all for bringing this forward. I'd be happy to answer any questions. But yeah, thank you again.
Thank you. Annie Levinson-Falk, followed by Shahid Gear.
Morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board, an independent advocate for Minnesota's utility customers. I'll keep my comments brief because I know you have a long list of testifiers following me. I'm speaking today in support of the bill. In particular, I want to speak to a portion of the bill that unleashes the potential of energy data in a way that protects ratepayers. In the coming years, hundreds of millions of dollars will be invested in technologies like smart meters, generating much more data than was imagined when Minnesota's energy statutes were written. This bill will make sure that that data is available to the consumer whose money is being invested. It will ensure that consumers in all parts of the state have access to their own data and allow them to share their data with a third party should they choose to do so. It will allow third parties to access summary energy data, enabling groups like CUB to identify rate designs and programs to help people use utility systems more efficiently, saving money. And it will create standards to ensure that consumers' energy data is protected and never sold. Thank you to Chair Wagenius for including this in your omnibus, to Representative Long for carrying the bill, and to Representatives Hornstein, Garofalo, Mahoney, and Stevenson, who are among the bill's co-sponsors.
Thank you. Oh, we have a question from Representative Bo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that your organization kind of represents consumer best interest. I've always been concerned about mandates, and so I'm curious from your point of view, are there provisions in this bill that will help protect consumers from rate hikes and increases in costs if the mandates that are in the bill don't work as envisioned?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but you probably have in mind specifically the 100% clean energy portions of the bill in particular. That was the way that we looked at that drafting, that language as well, is to make sure, you know, we hear from consumers, the first thing we hear is they want to save money and they're concerned about their bills. Probably number two to that is they want their energy to be clean, so we're looking for how can we provide or how can utilities provide the most clean energy in a way that is affordable and doesn't harm reliability. I think that the language in this bill has the flexibility to do that. The way that I read it, and I'm not the expert on that provision, but the way that I read it, if a utility were to get to a point where adding more clean energy would be cost prohibitive or would harm affordability or would hurt the reliability of the system, there's an off-ramp to that, the same as it existed for our current renewable energy standard. I think it was a concern back in 2007 when we put our current standard into law, and that situation didn't really materialize, which is fantastic. I think there's a good chance that as the technology evolves and grid managers learn how to use it, that we'll be able to continue to raise that ceiling of how much renewables the grid can take, but I'm not an engineer. I don't know that that's true, and I think the bill has the flexibility to manage that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope so, but I do still have concerns. Yet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Shahid Gear, and then on deck is is Shahid here? Doesn't appear to be. Then we have a representative of the Lignite Energy Council. And following would be Jesse Syme with Prairie Island Indian Community.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Joe Selwood with Cook Girard Associates, testifying on behalf of the Lignite Energy Council. Our members currently provide affordable, reliable, and dispatchable electricity from North Dakota's lignite coal reserves that supply power to over a million homes in Minnesota. I believe there's a letter in your packets from Jason Bohr, the president and CEO of the Lignite Energy Council, that outlines our opposition to House File 1833. One highlight I want to note of specific opposition is the 100% carbon-free provision. The Lignite Energy Council, through partnerships with the private companies based in Minnesota, the North Dakota Industrial Commission, and the U.S. Department of Energy, we have already begun working on carbon capture and sequestration projects such as Project Tundra that will greatly reduce carbon emissions without any mandates. However, our work is threatened by mandates that would force unreliable technology into the marketplace where the costs and risks would be borne by the Minnesota families and businesses. If the committee seeks to reduce CO2, we can help in a way that is seamless to Minnesota customers, painless to the economy, and harmless to the environment. Please vote no on the 100% carbon-free mandate provision in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Jesse Syme, Prairie Island Indian Community. And on deck is Ross Abbey with U.S. Solar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair. My name is Jesse Syme, and I'm General Counsel for the Prairie Island Indian Community. I'm also a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. President Buck asked me to send her regrets. She could not be here in person today. Tribal elder passed away in the services conflict with this hearing. I would like to testify on Section 59 and 61, Subdivision 8 of the bill, which appropriates $2 million in fiscal year 2020 and $3 million in fiscal year 2021 from the Renewable Development Account to Prairie Island for the construction of renewable energy systems. I would like to thank the chair and the committee for including the $5 million in the bill for Prairie Island. However, the appropriation is not adequate for Prairie Island to achieve its goal of becoming a net zero energy community. And we encourage you to adopt the fully funded proposal in the governor's budget. As you'll recall, our proposal, House File 2126, appropriates $46.2 million to the Prairie Island Indian Community out of the RDA, which would result in Prairie Island becoming one of the only Native American tribes in the country that is net zero. Our plan includes both energy conservation at a cost of $10.2 million and an energy generation component at a cost of $26 million. We believe this bold plan will result in the state and Prairie Island becoming nation leaders in sustainable energy. The community is excited about its energy future that includes sustainable resources to power its homes and businesses for years to come. Lastly, and this is really important, and I'd like to take time to underscore this, the historical context for our proposal, which is unique to any other body, any other organization coming to ask for funds from the RDA. As a result of the state's past energy policies, the Prairie Island Indian Community sits only 600 yards from the Prairie Island nuclear power plant and 44 dry casks of spent nuclear waste. So that's about the distance from the front door of the Capitol to the MnDOT cafeteria. And no other human beings are located that close to a nuclear power plant in this entire country. And in that, the tribe is the first responders and takes a huge amount of responsibility for disasters that could potentially happen at that plant. And while the tribe has shouldered the burden of the state's nuclear waste storage policy, the community has never asked for funds from the RDA, despite over $327 million having been spent out of the account since its inception in 1994. We believe that this project not only moves towards a sustainable and clean energy future, but it also is a recognition of the historical injustices borne by the Prairie Island Indian community. We believe we have an opportunity before us to implement a bold vision for Prairie Island that results in the state and Prairie Island become nation leaders in sustainable energy, and we would urge you to fund this project in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you, and please convey our condolences to President Buck and the community for your loss.
Thank you.
Next, we have Ross Abbey.
Good morning. My name is Ross Abbey with U.S. Solar. U.S. Solar is a 20-person development shop based here in Minnesota, founded back in 2015 specifically to serve the Minnesota market for these community solar gardens, both building the projects, delivering the energy to the utility, and also subscribing out the projects. I want to thank Chair Wagenius, Representative Long, and the entire committee for working to expand access to community solar gardens in this bill. I'll just speak to that element of the bill, specifically at lines 9.2 to 9.9. This effectively modifies the current contiguous county requirement to allow for more rural CSGs, and it really benefits rural landowners by allowing them to start hosting these 1-megawatt CSG facilities. The benefits are many. It includes, on average, something like a $2 million investment into the local economy, including over 40 jobs per 1-megawatt site. It increases the property tax on the 8 to 10 acres that the solar garden takes up from ag rate up to commercial rate. Of course, that benefits the local tax base. That increases paid by the developers. Allowing for this expansion also increases and diversifies farm owner income over the 25-year term of these projects. Depending on how close the farmer is to a substation or favorable interconnection point, they can fetch lease rates up to $1,000 or more per acre, times 10 acres, times 25 years. It's over $250,000 to the farm family to be able to host one of these sites. And typically what they'll do is they'll ask the developer to put it on their least productive acres, you know, the back 8 or 10 acres. My company and others have committed to installing all these sites with pollinator-friendly vegetation. That's native grasses and wildflowers that are good for the habitat for bees and butterflies, songbirds, even game birds. It also benefits the soil quality, water quality for these sites. And then finally, we also have to pay, as developers, we pay on average over $380,000 to upgrade the local wires and substations of the utility. That means neighbors benefit by being able to plug into new three-phase power that's running down the street, running down the county road. That's a higher quality power and allows them to invest in additional on-farm activities. I also did bring a letter from 14 rural landowners, if I could circulate this. Just expresses their support for the bill. Last but not least, I also want to mention that this language at line 9.2 to 9.9 also benefits subscribers. For the first time, this puts a 10% requirement on eligible projects that they have to serve at least 10% of their capacity to residential subscribers. And it also makes it more possible to serve those subscribers by getting rid of the arbitrary restrictions. And finally, it benefits subscribers because in addition to access, now they have more portability because they can move across the metro. If you're a resident, if you're a low-income renter, it's even more important because you can move anywhere in the territory and take the solar benefits with you. So with that, I conclude my remarks. Thank you.
We have a question from Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. How many acres do you think this bill would cover? So you talked a little bit about each project potentially, 8 to 10 acres. If you were to combine all the work that this bill, what do you estimate that would take?
Mr. Abbey?
Chair, committee member, representative. It's hard for me to speculate, especially there's many different components of the bill. What I could say is to date there have been about 500 megawatts installed, mostly around the Twin Cities metro area. 10 acres each, call it 5,000 acres of solar so far, and this maybe could double that.
Representative Susinski. And then just a follow-up, just to kind of from your business, sounds like you started in 2015 kind of around the community solar projects. How many projects has your business done?
Mr. Abbey?
We've probably got 70 or 80 in the pipeline, and at least I think 15 are already built and delivering energy to the grid.
Thank you. And just a follow-up, kind of some of the other members talked a little bit, you know, they kind of folks that are doing your projects, you know, they build some and then they keep some, but they also sell some after they're completed. Kind of what's your makeup? You know, the 70, 80 are in the pipeline. Do you have buyers for those already? Or kind of where, from a secondary market, where you guys kind of fit in that mix?
Mr. Abbey.
Chair, Representative, for our initial portfolio, for the first program year, we're able to kind of get applications, and it's a two-year process to build them. We had partnered a joint venture with a Canadian utility to make that happen. They took the assets under that deal. Going forward, we think we're in a good position to develop and then maintain our own ownership. That allows us to maintain operations, provide better service to, obviously, our landowner hosts, neighbors, and subscribers.
Thank you. So a Canadian company for your initial 15 or so?
Yes, I think it's the Power Company of Canada.
Oh, would it be Manitoba?
Representative Susinski? Mr. Abbey?
Chair, Representative. No, it was not Manitoba Power, to the best of my knowledge.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Baker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to testify, the other night we learned a lot about kind of community garden solars and how they work and how they developed, and I learned a lot that night. Some of the things in this bill here today are about this, a little more transparency and third-party vendors, third parties getting information on rates and how ratepayers are using their energy, and it's kind of it's heartburn for some people on this committee to kind of open that up. There's some data privacy stuff there and so on. In your world with community solar gardens, I asked some questions the other night about how those subscription agreements work. And would you be open to allowing that information when names are taken off the subscription agreements that you sign up, people, would you be all right with allowing that to be, you know, kind of public for the PUC to examine, to kind of see how that works when we're establishing the value of solar and other things, so that we can kind of see how these deals are put together, how the profits are shared, how that stuff works? What in your opinion, do you think that's the right approach as well?
Mr. Abbey.
Chair, Representative, certainly the Commission can ask those materials, I think, at their own discretion. In terms of our subscription agreements, we just use a standard form for all of our residential subscribers. It's basically already public information. Anyone who wants to look at it for purposes of evaluation, potentially participating, obviously we're happy to share that.
Okay, thank you. That's it for now.
Thank you. We have three more testifiers. We have 2 minutes left till time, but I'm hoping members will allow us to go just a few minutes over. There's nobody following us, so hopefully we can try to get through these folks. Lauren Lugtug up next, and then on deck is Brendan Jordan.
Move where I can see the chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lauren Lontag with Ottertail Power in Fergus Falls. And just as a reminder, we serve half our customers in Minnesota, half in the Dakotas, and we serve a lot of little towns between 100 and 500 residents. First of all, I want to thank a few people for some accommodations, for trying to make accommodations. Section 15, the energy storage section, we are looking forward to doing some pilot projects with energy storage, and the energy storage Association worked with us a good part of last session. Some additions to the bill in this body were probably not helpful. Section 17, 18, 21, and 29, the energy savings and optimization sections. The Center for Energy and Efficiency has worked with us, and we got that piece of the bill to a point where we think we could work with it. Sections 30 through 38, the changes to the IRP statute, Representative Stevenson and the Center for Energy and Efficiency, we worked hard on that part of the bill for a long time. Subdivision 4, unfortunately, in Section 34, dealing with ownership requiring 80% by 2030. That's probably not doable in any way by my company, especially for a fraction of ownership to reach 80% by 2030. The carrots and the sticks are a little out of whack in that part of the bill, I'll say. Sections 42 and 43, Representative Long's beneficial electrification. By the way, the sections, Representative Baker, the sections I'm mentioning, we have spent time negotiating with parties over a period of time. Representative Long's beneficial electrification had some good ideas. I testified in favor of it here. These were not negotiated, so either Representative Long got lucky as a freshman legislator or he was well advised by someone. Section 44, solar for schools. David Schaefer from the Minnesota Solar Energy Association, we've worked for quite a while on that together, as Mr. Sulem said, and we already have a solar on schools program, and we think that part of the bill could be useful in applying for grants to achieve that. And we'd like to especially do that in schools where we have economic difficulties. Section 60, the Coordinated Transmission Study, the Center for Energy and Efficiency, and the Clean Grid Alliance worked with us to negotiate that. The other sections of the bill are, from my assessment of the bill, are not negotiated and not agreed to, and in particular the 100% carbon-free standard that the governor proposed. I mean, we weren't totally surprised by this, but I don't know if it's the bridge too far or if it's the leap of faith. First of all, let me say there are no zero-cost futures for any utility, no zero-cost increase futures. Even our coal plants over time have to be refurbished. So everything that we do costs money in some way. The choices we have are wind, gas, and solar, and unless you have access to large hydro, as some do, or energy storage. And so the idea of taking gas out of that equation entirely by 2050 is not likely, in my opinion. The polar vortex of January 29 to 31, we gave testimony this committee was in the minus 30s in much of our service territory, and we had zero performance from our wind facilities for 48 hours. So in the absence of black boxes or those sorts of things, my advice would be to proceed very cautiously with things like the 100% carbon-free standard. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and that concludes my testimony.
Thank you so much. Next up is Brandon Jordan with Great Plains, and our final testifier this morning will be Nick Mark with CenterPoint.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Brendan Jordan. I represent Drive Electric Minnesota. First, I wanted to quickly address Representative Baker's question about consultation. The Drive Electric Minnesota community was certainly consulted on this, and our membership includes the auto industry, Auto Dealers Association, a number of private charging entities, a variety of clean air and clean energy organizations, as well as investor-owned municipal and rural electric co-ops all over the state of Minnesota. Drive Electric Minnesota is strongly supportive of, and let me be clear that I'm talking about sections 46 and 47 before I get myself in trouble for implying I was talking about the entire bill. But the electric vehicle provisions in section 46 and 47 do enjoy strong support from the electric vehicle industry in the state. We feel that it's a sensible approach to helping to grow this emerging industry and get us to the point where we do achieve cost effectiveness. Battery prices are dropping rapidly. We already have some emerging opportunities in the state, like electric vehicle bus manufacturing in St. Cloud, EV automation facility in Brooklyn Park, in addition to a whole variety of other great things happening. Mr. Chair and members, I would like to highlight sort of a couple of issues with the provisions, particularly in Section 46. When it comes to funding, a couple of things to highlight. The sort of the original numbers in House File 2233 were intended to achieve a doubling of EV sales And then the funding was a mix of renewable development account and general fund match. And a couple of things to just, one of the things to note there is obviously there are a lot of competing priorities, but if there's a way to get closer to the original amounts, that would be helpful in kind of keeping with the original intent. And also just to highlight that we believe there's opportunity for statewide growth in EV sales. And so just making sure that because of the restrictions on RDA funding, that rebates could go to Xcel Energy and non-Xcel Energy customers, which was originally proposed to be achieved through a general fund match. I know this bill does not address general fund, but that's something for the committee to consider going forward. We would be happy to contribute providing additional data on which percentage of EV sales are likely to be eligible or ineligible to try to refine what really the right number ought to be. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Our final testifier this morning is Nick Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nick Mark. I manage conservation and renewable energy policy for CenterPoint Energy. This is a big bill, and I'm not going to speak to everything in it. As you might imagine, there are things that we are supportive of in the bill, as well as some other items that we have concerns about. We have been very involved in the stakeholder conversations over the last year regarding the changes to the SIP statute. I think the final language that's before us today doesn't look exactly like what our group settled on, but it's awful close, and we are generally supportive of the changes. In particular, I think the language around pre-weatherization measures is really helpful and could allow us to really reach a lot of folks that currently are not able to receive weatherization benefits due to vermiculite or asbestos issues in their homes, and we kind of have to walk away from those. With regard to the efficient fuel switching language, I can live with the language that's in the bill. I would have preferred to see a requirement that a utility pursuing efficient fuel switching needed to be decoupled, but as I say, I can live with what's there. And I also want to highlight the language in Section 16 around innovative clean technologies. I'm really excited about that. That could create an opportunity for us to develop some exciting technologies such as power to gas that are currently kind of in their infancy and could represent a terrific way to utilize both the gas and electric grids sort of in a complementary and mutually reinforcing way. Our concerns with the bill, you've heard from us before about the data privacy language. I don't want to take up too much time reiterating those concerns. And then I have a little bit of concern around the creation of the state policy goal directly in the IRP statute. I'm looking at section 33, where we say it's the state's policy to pursue clean energy sources. As I read the definitions that are set up in that section of statute, that would exclude renewable natural gas from qualifying as a clean energy resource unless it's burned for electric generation. We're really excited about renewable natural gas. I've spoken with a number of you, and I've tried to telegraph that it wasn't going to be the last time you'll hear from me about RNG. I don't think this is either. But we think it's really important to recognize the benefits of RNG. And because it is, although it is more expensive currently than conventional natural gas, it is frequently a lower cost way to reduce emissions than electrification. So we think it needs to be included in the state's suite of clean energy resources. And that's all I had for the committee.
Thank you so much. Thank you all members for your flexibility with us going a little over time. The committee will recess and reconvene at 4:30 back in this room, and we'll be starting at 4:30 with Commissioner Steve Kelly. Committee is now in recess.
Somebody said
the division is reconvening, and we are going to start with Commissioner Steve Kelly. Welcome to committee. Commissioner Kelly, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for allowing me to be here this afternoon. I'm Steve Kelly. I am the Commissioner of Commerce for the state of Minnesota. And I would like to thank Chair Wagenius for including the governor's One Minnesota Path to Clean Energy in the committee's draft omnibus bill. I also want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for carrying that initial proposal. And really, I have a relatively short message today. Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan are championing the One Minnesota Path to Clean Energy. As you all know, it's a set of policy proposals that will lead our state's electricity sector to 100% clean energy by 2050. The plan will drastically cut air pollution while creating jobs and opportunity for people across Minnesota. The One Minnesota Path to Clean Energy maximizes investments in the lowest cost energy while including in protections to ensure that the lights stay on. The department looks forward to continuing to work with this committee and stakeholders as these provisions progress in the legislative process. So thank you for taking the time, and appreciate it, Chairman and Representative Wagenius, for allowing me to make this brief presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner Kelly, and I think we have some questions for you. Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the PUC voted today to uphold Line 3, and so is the Walz administration going to appeal that decision? Can you tell us?
Commissioner Kelly.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bowe, the governor has answered that question on previous occasions, and the answer is that he intends that the department appeal the commission's denial of our petition for reconsideration.
Thank you. Further questions for Commissioner Kelly? Seeing none, thank you so much, Commissioner, and please thank the governor and lieutenant governor for their leadership.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we have John Dunlop, and on deck is Kelly Dooley.
Chair Long, members of the committee, my name is John Dunlop. I'm a licensed professional engineer in the state of Minnesota, based in Minneapolis. I have been working on renewable energy policies and programs for over 40 years. I managed the renewable energy programs for the state energy office for 15 years, and then I managed technical programs for the Trade Association for Wind Power in the United States, the American Wind Energy Association, for over 20 years. I have witnessed the incredible growth of the wind and solar industries in America during my career. Renewable energy installations increased from virtually zero back in 1980 to supplying 25% of all the electricity currently being used in the state. In spite of the increased use of renewables, we have failed to achieve the underlying objective to curb dramatic impacts of climate change. We have failed to keep carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to less than 350 parts per million, considered to be the limit in order to continue life as we know it. We have failed to ensure that our children and our grandchildren will live in a world similar to what we enjoy. In order to constrain global warming to no more than a half a degree, just a half a degree above today's temperature, we must totally eliminate carbon emissions from the electric and transportation sectors within 2 decades. The carbon-free standard for 100% clean energy contained in this bill strides significantly toward the sustainable future for our next generation. I also am the chair of the American Solar Energy Society annual conference to be held in Minnesota in August. The conference, for the first time ever, will focus only on using renewable energy to take immediate climate action that will result in carbon-free electric and transportation sectors nationally by 2040. We look forward to highlighting the progress being taken by our own state of Minnesota based on the passage of this bill. Thank you, Chair Long and members of the committee.
Thank you. I think we have a question for you, Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just into the testify, thanks for coming in today. Just was kind of, you know, so you talked a little bit about the amount of CO2. Do you feel like the goals set forth are aggressive enough in your mind, or do you think they should be more aggressive? And you kind of, that 12-year thing, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Can I have you repeat part of that, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, to the testifier. So just kind of wanted to chat about, do you feel that these are aggressive enough goals for the state of Minnesota? Do you think they should be more aggressive? And then what are your thoughts on, you know, if we fail to act in the next 10 years, what do you think is going to happen?
Mr. Dunlop.
Chairman Long, Representative, I personally believe that the objective that is outlined in the bill is far too relaxed. I think that we need to change more rapidly than that. I think that we need to have significant impact within the next 12 years by 2030, not 2040 or 2050. We are in a crisis situation, and I am extremely concerned about our children and their children, and they will not enjoy the world that we currently enjoy.
Representative Swidzinski.
And obviously, making policy is, you know, kind of like making sausage a little bit. If you had a, you know, crystal ball, if you could just kind of wave a magic wand and create policy at the state level, what would be your goal, you know, to reach or whatever that would be, kind of a timeline, and what do you think would work best?
Mr. Dunlop.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am very excited about the economic opportunities that we're talking about here. It's going to be a major transformation of our economy, of our business. We're going to spend billions of dollars on new renewable energy systems, and we are going to, it will be highly disruptive because we will indeed be putting people out of work. We will be changing jobs. We will be changing our focus. We need to launch that immediately in order to achieve that significant impact that we need to make to start to bring down the number of parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. And we need to start doing that now.
Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you.
Next we have Kelly Dooley. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. Chairman.
And then Rob Scott Hovland is on deck.
Mr. Chair, House Committee, my name is Kelly Dooley, and I live in Bloomington, Minnesota. I have two young children, a first grader and a preschooler. We have 10 years or less to change our habits and how we power our lives to prevent future climate change, which makes me scared for my children's future. 10 years is not much time for being slow to action, which is why I'm here. I became a leader with the Sierra Club's Climate Parents Program because of these concerns. Through the program, I and many other parents are working to move school districts toward 100% renewable energy here in Minnesota. That's why I'm really excited about the solar and schools funding portion of HF 1833, particularly lines 57.21 through 61.5 and 76.1 through 76.11, solar and schools with appropriation, and lines 61.6 through 64.1, solar and schools and Excel service territory. Switching to 100% renewable energy is one of the many priorities for school districts, but the solar and schools funding within the bill, HF 1833, will make switching to 100% renewable energy a priority now. And like you just heard the last speaker, it is a priority now. When I and other parents, kids, and teachers approach school districts, we will be able to make an even better case for the viability of solar in schools. School districts switching to 100% renewable energy will not only have a local but a global impact in preventing further climate change. I'm really excited, to be honest, to be here to actually speaking with you guys, and that Minnesota is taking the lead and moving towards 100% renewable energy with this bill. So please vote to support Bill HF 1833.
Thank you so much. Rob Scott Hovland, and following would be Maxwell J. Dixon.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Rob Scott Hovland with Missouri River Energy Services, and I want to thank you for allowing me to comment today on our concerns with the amended House file version of House File 1833. As a generation and transmission supplier to 61 municipal utilities, 25 of which are located here in Minnesota, Missouri River's primary concern is reliability. Our job under state and federal laws is to ensure that our municipal utilities and their customers have reliable energy resources that are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and have reliable transmission to provide them that energy. The proposed changes to the IRP and the Certificate of Need processes will make it extremely difficult, if not impossible, to plan, purchase, build renewable resources such as natural gas. Technology does not exist today to bring us fully to 100% carbon free. Until that technology is ready, other resources like natural gas, at least for peaking purposes, must remain a part of that sustained mix to sustain reliability not only in Minnesota but within the region. More transmission will also be needed. The scope of the Governor's Clean Energy Act will require energy resources from beyond Minnesota's borders with transmission pathways leading out of state. Major transmission projects require 10 years or more for planning, development, approval, and construction. And additionally, transmission is quite expensive. Section 60 of the bill provides for a limited transmission study. We believe the study proposal should be expanded to encompass what will be needed in Minnesota and the region to accommodate the vast changes that will occur on our electric grid. And that this study should also improve MISO and SPP as the regional transmission providers. MRES also agrees with the concerns raised this morning by MMUA in their testimony. We hope that we can work with you to address these issues as the legislation moves forward. Thank you for your time and for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much. Maxwell J. Dixon, and following will be Michael Cartwright.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Vice Chair and members of the committee. My name is Max J. Dixon. I'm a Twin Cities native, now living in the central neighborhood of Minneapolis, and I'm here as a volunteer leader with the Sierra Club, speaking in support of the bill. I'm happy to be representing the many more members of the club who are enthusiastically supporting this bill. I've testified before this committee before, speaking on the 100% carbon-free standard, and at that time I shared with you some of my personal experiences having lived in Gulf Coast in communities that are already seeing businesses close and that are seeing families, in many cases who have lived there for generations, leave because of the impacts of climate change. I know that you have heard throughout the session from many experts who are warning you that those changes are coming to Minnesota soon as well, and that we will feel those impacts too unless drastic action is taken. I believe that we can and we need to commit to generating electricity without carbon emissions. We can and we need to create opportunities to invest as a state in renewables with programs like solar on schools and community solar gardens. I believe that we need to make sure that our clean energy economy creates benefits for everyone in the state, and that we need to pave the way for beneficial electrification of other areas like transportation. This is a really strong vision, and I know that you're going to be considering many amendments to this bill throughout the process. Please don't walk back that vision and don't water this down. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael Cartwright and then Paul Helgeson.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about my experience with solar energy initiatives. I've been a physics teacher at Moundsview High School for the past 27 years. My name is Michael Cartwright, and 4 years ago, I finally realized the financial and environmental benefits of solar, and it finally became affordable through the incentive program. I put a 6-kilowatt system on my home, and it's been great. I also learned of the opportunity for schools to benefit from this program as well. And in the past 3 years, Mounds Hugh School District has put 40-kilowatt systems on 13 of their school buildings, and we're estimated to save over $1 million in the next 20 years on energy costs. I'm very excited about the opportunity to try to approach 100%. Even though we have 40 kilowatts on Mounds Hugh High School, it only covers about 5% of our electric needs. And, you know, we need close to a megawatt to cover everything, but I'm hopeful that through this new program, we might have that opportunity. We've been working to develop new curriculum to involve solar in our students' education. We're trying to match the new science standards, and we're actually adding a new energy concepts course to encourage students to pursue careers in electrical and mechanical engineering, as well as solar technician, through our use of solar. I recently met with Climate Parents and the Sierra Club regarding their goal of 100% renewable schools. I'm hopeful that this bill can help my high school lead the way and show it's possible to approach this admirable goal. And personally, I know that roofs can be a challenge, so I'm really personally looking forward to the possibility of developing some solar carports, because those parking lots just sit and collect energy. So that would be my personal goal. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Paul Helgeson, and following will be Reverend Tyler Sitt.
Hello, my name is Paul Helgeson. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I live in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of environmental groups like MN350. Previously, I was the sustainability manager at a large regional food company, and during my 10 years in that role, I worked on many aspects of sustainability, including reducing our carbon footprint. We looked at many technologies that are featured in this bill that I support, and I just want to say that of all of the opportunities for energy efficiency improvement the company had, our biggest gain came during our carbon reporting came when the grid emission factor was lowered at an EPA level, in part because of the successful mandate in Minnesota and neighboring areas to reduce the carbon intensity of the grid electricity. Minnesota is home to many large publicly traded companies, and consumers and investors are looking at things like their carbon reporting as proxies for how well they're managed and how they're valued. I think it's critical for Minnesota to maintain its role as a leader in serving these businesses by giving them clean electricity in their grid. This is one of the main ways large companies can reduce their overall carbon footprint, and it needs to come at scale, at a grid scale. So I strongly support the mandate for the sake of making Minnesota a business climate that can help our companies succeed, because climate change is a morally urgent situation. We need to dramatically cut emissions, and we have the technology to do that. In addition to the grid, I did a lot of work on combined power and on-site renewables, and the technology is there, it can scale, and it can help business become more resilient. As these production facilities enhance efficiency, they'll find greater resilience in their operations. So this is a win-win for business, and it's a win for Minnesota's economy, and it's a win for our future. Please support our bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Hold on one sec. We have a question for you, if you don't mind. Representative Baker.
Super simple. I don't know, Mr. Chair, if he actually said his name at the beginning. I just want to make sure I got his name and where he's from.
Paul Helgeson. I'm a resident in St. Paul.
That was it. Thank you.
Sure thing. Reverend Tyler Sitt. And then on deck is Pam Marshall.
Thank you, Chairperson and members of the committee. My name is Pastor Tyler Sitt. I am the pastor of New City Church in South Minneapolis, which is where I also live. New City is a multi-ethnic, mostly millennial church that is one of the fastest growing congregations in the United Methodist Church in Minnesota. And the reason why it's growing so fast is because we are a church that focuses on environmental justice. Millennials have a lot of anxiety about our current climate crisis and what it means for our collective future. You heard right. Climate change is so scary that even millennials are coming back to church. Right now, New City is in the middle of a sermon series on environmental justice because we think it's appropriate that we, in this season leading up to Easter, that we consider the death of Jesus and the disproportionate effects and burdens that we're putting on poor people and people of color because of environmental justice, injustices, and also considering the resurrection of our God and the new hope that bold action might create in our world. I am encouraging you to take bold action, to take today as an opportunity to pass a bill that would lead to 100% clean energy. This bill would provide economic opportunities for millennials like the people in my community to be part of a clean energy future that we all want to live in. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Pam Marshall, and then up next would be Michael Noble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Pam Marshall, and for the last 27 years, I have directed the Energy Sense Coalition. Energy Sense is the only statewide advocacy organization dedicated exclusively to the promotion of affordable energy service. Through the affordability programs offered by Xcel and CenterPoint, we provide utility bill payment assistance as a supplement to the federal LIHEAP program to about 33,000 households a year. We also currently work with Xcel to administer their low-income SIP program in the East Metro area and with CenterPoint to deliver the only low-income SIP program dedicated exclusively to renters in 1-to-4-unit dwellings. We support the increase in funding levels to the low-income SIP program. I'm referring primarily to Section 26 on pages 40 to 42. We've worked with utilities and others who agreed that this increase and the use of 15% of these funds to prepare homes for weatherization is appropriate policy. Currently, we have to walk away from some of the oldest and least efficient homes because no funds are available to remove knob and tube wiring or vermiculite. These conditions exist in about 15% of all the energy audits that we or our partners conduct out of a total of about 200 audits a year, just in the two programs I referred to earlier. Attic insulation cannot be added on top of knob and tube wiring or before any existing vermiculite is first extracted. By allowing a limited amount of SIP funds to be used to remove these barriers, this new provision ensures that we can insulate some of the highest consumption dwellings. Utilities are already surpassing the current low-income SIP spending amounts, but those amounts do not reach the levels included in this bill. I believe that the additional low-income spending targets promote more equitable access to SIP, a program to which all residential ratepayers contribute, including low-income customers. Just one other note, Mr. Chair and members, as currently drafted, on page 24 of the bill, at line 2419, after the word renters, it seems to me that's where the definition of low income at 60% of state median income should be included. That way it applies to both COUs and IOUs, which was the intention to define it consistently. Right now, that definition is included in on line 2913, and as such, it would only apply to the consumer-owned utilities. That's all I have, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Michael Noble, and then on deck is Jamie Fitzke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Noble. I'm the Executive Director of Fresh Energy. I want to thank the committee chair, Chair Wagenius, and Vice Chair Jamie Long for inviting us here today and helping to put together this bill. I want to acknowledge Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's vision for this 100% clean and renewable energy goal. It's been about 12 years since the legislature and Governor Pawlenty came together for the Next Generation Energy Act, and I believe 95% of members of both parties supported that landmark legislation 12 years ago. We met that goal, that original goal of 25% renewable energy standard. We met that about 9 years early, and by all accounts, with a downward pressure on people's electric bills and electric rates. And now it's time to set a new standard, a new goal. And the 100% clean and renewable energy standard is, it's the right standard, it's the right goal. It's what consumers want, what's the science, the climate science requires of us. It's where the markets are headed. It's what civic leaders are calling for. Many companies around the world are moving on 100% renewable energy, 100% clean energy, including St. Paul company Ecolab, which is 212 on the Fortune 500 list, has already achieved 100% renewable energy for all of its North America operations. A company like 3M has achieved it for its Minnesota operations and is committed to 100% clean and renewable energy for worldwide operations. Cities like Rochester and Duluth and Minneapolis-St. Paul have all committed to the same goal. This provision, this ambition is going to drive jobs and economic development and small business. But there are many other supporting policies and supporting bills that have been pulled into this committee provision, committee provisions that will help advance the clean and renewable energy goal, like the beneficial electrification bill, Section 42 and 43, and the energy optimization language that is modernizing our conservation improvement programs. We worked actually quite closely for months and months with the consumer-owned utilities and got close. I don't think the bill reflects how close we might have gotten, and unfortunately neither does the Senate bill, but I think there's a lot of progress that was made in those conversations. I think the stretch code language is quite strong and quite important, and there's many, many other provisions in this bill will help to get to this 100% clean renewable energy vision. I know it's a long, long way to go between now and the end of the session, but Fresh Energy is really committed to working with members of both political parties and all the stakeholders and our friends at the utilities and small business and in the labor unions and consumer groups and faith groups and the youth activists. We'd like everybody to pull together the way we did in 2007 when everybody moved major public policy legislation to put us on this path to a clean energy future. So with that, I thank you for recognizing Fresh Energy today.
Thank you very much. Jamie Fitzke, and then Thor Underdahl is on deck.
Chair and members of the Energy Committee, I'm Jamie Fitzke, Policy Manager at the Center for Energy and Environment. We actively support many sections within this bill and thank the committee for including them in the omnibus. In particular, we applaud the committee for taking bold steps forward in resource planning by increasing transparency and the use of cost-effective resources, such as energy efficiency, load management, and renewable energy through the Clean Energy First provisions included in this bill. We also appreciate the focus on transmission planning, as it is a critical component in the clean energy transition, and the committee's inclusion of the opportunity for utilities to own replacement assets when they retire fossil fuel generation, as we think it's an important provision. We are also pleased that the Conservation Improvement Program is innovating to include load management and efficient fuel switching, while remaining focused on energy efficiency, the most cost-effective energy resource we have. These forward-looking approaches address energy in front of and behind the meter, and will help all Minnesotans utilize affordable, reliable, and increasingly clean energy. There is one small area of concern, and have spoken to members and staff. It refers to Section 30, page 47, lines 26 and 27, which define clean energy resources and references energy conservation. We believe energy efficiency is the better term and ask the committee to consider this change. As each is defined, energy conservation is limited to activities that result in a reduction of energy use, where energy efficiency includes those activities, while also allowing for activities that result in more productive use of energy as well. In addition, we think it's critical that load management opportunities be included in the definition of clean energy resources. Load management refers to the shifting the time of energy use to off-peak, which will continue to be a necessary part of resource planning. These definitional changes are important to meeting the goals of the Clean Energy First provisions within the bill. We look forward to working with members of the committee on this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Next is Thor Underdahl, and then on deck is Shahid Gear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Thor Underdahl with Minnesota Power, and appreciate the opportunity to speak here. Appreciate Chair Wagenius putting together this bill and the robust discussions we've had over the last couple months. I just want to express a couple of items in the bill that we've testified on before, so nothing new, so I'll try to be concise about those. The first one would be on Section 3, on Page 3, the customer energy data provisions. I think we're very much for accessing data, our customers accessing their data, and we provide standard consent forms to do so, and third-party access under authorization, and we are very much a part of the many years process that went on at the Public Utilities Commission to define how that works for investor-owned utilities. And we think of particular concern is competitive data for our large industrial customers and the set standard for aggregation of anonymized data. We have our own standard that we recently filed with the Public Utilities Commission, and we feel like the utility situation should be considered on a case-by-case basis. We also are very supportive of continuing the discussion on how to move the energy system forward. We would prefer options that partner with utilities and work towards incentives rather than mandates. We've seen that work very well in other states, and I think we can utilize those here. And then finally, on page 74 in section 60, just because it hasn't been noted yet, there's a coordinated electric transmission study. And while we do think that is headed in the right direction, there's a different version that allows that to be conducted by MISO, the Midwest Independent System Operator, who really has overview over these subjects, and we wouldn't want to circumvent that process. It's an important part of the process. And also, as it currently stands, it would flow through as a cost to the electric utility customers. And in speaking with our transmission engineers, those become very expensive. So I don't know that it's been on record what that would cost, but we've estimated that it could be in the millions of dollars. So we would want to know that before that was passed along to our customers ultimately. I did want to highlight some things that I really appreciate in this bill and efforts that have been very collaborative. Representative Acom, really appreciate all your efforts, and I think Solar on Schools has really moved to a really great spot, and we support that. There are several energy storage provisions in here that many people have been working on for quite a long time. On Section 38 and Section 30, those were both really good portions of a previous energy storage bill that allow for pilot projects rather than mandated projects. We think that's a great way to move forward. There's great elements in here around electrification and in the transportation sector, another industry we need to look at. And then also Representative Wagenius's, Chair Wagenius's bill on the conservation financial incentive. We think that's another incentive that heads in the right direction. So appreciate the opportunity to testify and happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. You do have a unique business up in northern Minnesota, Minnesota Power. You make power for a lot of big customers up there. And as we sit and kind of work through this bill and try to focus on what I think is really important, I know to when I used to live up in International Falls, I know how important Minnesota Power's rates are to not only back then Boise Cascade, I think it's a different company now, and others. But if you guys up north lose a big customer, that's a major hit to folks. And I'm just worried about sort of some issues that could be causing us to see some serious increases in rates down the road if this kind of bill passes. Earlier today, I asked Mr. Eloff about a question about if utilities went in front of the PUC. And again, this is that 16.1, page 16, line 14. And Mr. Eloff kind of said it right. The commission, when requested to modify or delay implementation, they could do so if it was done by a utility. Have you, as a utility, ever exercised that? This isn't even a change. It's in current law. I'm just wondering if you've ever exercised something like that in the past, when you have concerns about something like this coming in front of the PUC.
Mr. Underdahl. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Baker. To my knowledge, we in particular haven't submitted any requests for a modification or delay of the standard. I don't believe any other utilities have. I think the question that maybe is probably on many people's minds then, how would that play out? And I know this is a long list of constraining factors, and some pull in different directions. And whenever you have a kind of almost a net benefit equation, you have to figure out how to weight these different things and where to decide where one kind of stands next to another. So I think it would be a very complicated question to answer. It'd certainly be prospective and not retrospective. You wouldn't be able to undo embedded costs, so that might be a concern as well, too. But I think just we haven't gone down that path yet, so we don't really know the answer.
And Representative Baker. Mr. Chair, thank you. I think that's kind of where I'm getting to as well. As I sit here, and I have the same goals as a lot of folks here, I want to see a cleaner air, carbon-free. I think this is really good stuff. But I also know that as I have this heartburn about what is this going to cost us, and I hear we have a pastor and we have young people and we have a teacher and all teaching good things and talking about our responsibility to get this clean, I'm always worried about what's this going to do to our energy costs and reliability. They're talking about so many times just clean and renewable, clean and renewable. Those are the only two words a lot of folks are using today. You're one of the folks that makes power. You have baseload power because companies need that. I guess my question might be is, as I have this heartburn, I might be misled. I may be having a lot of anxiety for nothing. I don't know, because we don't know what this is going to happen with the costs. But as this gets worked through and you start to see things moving in the right direction, how bad does it have to get for Minnesota Power for you to throw that white flag up and say, whoa, wait a minute, we better go in front of the PUC and say we have a real concern here because this is going to do some serious damage? Do you have any idea, is that potentially doubling the cost of power cost to your customers? Is it 20%? Is it 10%? Is there sort of that level of where you think you might have to say, hold on a second, we need to go to the PUC?
Mr. Underdahl. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Baker. I don't know that I have a hard and fast number. I think that's something we have to consider every time we think about a rate case or we do our integrated resource planning. I know certainly if we see significant, you know, we're a unique utility. So as has been stated many times, 60-70% of our load comes from 12 some customers. So they're big customers, and they make up a significant portion of paying for our overall costs. And so if we would see, you know, a large shedding of those customers because of pressures, they're not making investments in those, we're not seeing production at the same levels, I think we'd have to have a conversation about that. I don't know that we have a hard and fast number. And the other thing I would note, too, is that, you know, when we look at particularly the iron mining industry of northeastern Minnesota, when there's comparisons done on the way that's created in other parts of the world, it's 50% less carbon intense to produce taconite from northeastern Minnesota and steel, ultimately. So when we're talking about the climate as well, too, it's incredibly important that we think about emissions leakage. And if we were to put too much production pressure here on costs, we could ultimately be creating an actual detriment effect to the climate. And states like California have recognized that with free carbon credits during their cap and trade program.
Representative Baker. Final question, Mr. Chair, and just maybe more of a statement. And this is really not only to you, Mr. Underthal, but other companies that create power. I just hope that you start examining and diving into your resource plans sooner than later when it starts to affect what you think could be some real cost going forward. Honestly, once the rates get changed and it gets out there, it's like trying to put toothpaste back in the tube. And then you're going to lose, if you lose a company or two, it's going to be a problem. So I may be just worrying about nothing, but you are the smart folks that look at this all the time, and I hope that you get to the PUC before the wheels fall off, because, again, we want the same outcome. But I don't think the technology is quite here yet, and that makes me nervous as a former utility commissioner, because I know what it's like to go through these processes. I just urge your big caution as you move forward, because you have the only ability to stop this, or at least to modify it and go to the PUC. It's not a customer, but it's utilities. Thank you. That's all I have.
And I'm not the smart folk, but we have smart folks. Well, just want to clarify that on the record. Thank you very much. Shahid Gear, and then following will be Carolyn Berninger.
Hi, this is my first testify thingy, so excuse me for stuttering because I get scared a lot.
Would you mind stating your name for the record?
First and foremost, this session you have a chance to be the leading state in preventing the worst impacts of climate change. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, hi, my name is Shahad. I'm 17 and I go to Roosevelt High School in South Minneapolis. I'm testifying today on behalf of MNKOA and youth that can't be here today to ask the question, will Minnesota be 100% renewable in energy? We need to. As a youth, a big-time youth, we need to. I've always imagined graduating college, getting my degree in social work, having a family, and living my life to the fullest. I did not expect to have to hear in my biology class about a report called the IPCC stating that we have less than 10 years to change before we cross that threshold in which we can't come back from our mistakes. We need action, and it needs to start now. If this part of the bill is passed, I can have clean air. My kids will be able to have clean air. I'll be able to live in a world where I can let my future kids play in the snow or tan for all I care. We need this bill to be passed and maintained because if our future generations don't get what I get, it's not fair. We need it passed, and we need it passed now. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You did great. Carolyn Berninger. And then Stu Laurie.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today in support of House File 1833. My name is Carolyn Berninger. I am a Climate and Energy Program Associate at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. MCEA has been defending Minnesota's environment using the law and science since 1974. And we first want to thank this committee for your leadership in addressing climate change. This is one of the most pressing issues of our time, and one which our governor has rightly called an existential threat. With U.S. carbon emissions at an all-time high, and with a lack of federal action on climate change, it's time for states like Minnesota to step up and take bold action. As one of the fastest warming states, addressing climate change is particularly important for Minnesota. Fortunately, we know what needs to be done, and we have the resources to do it. Minnesota is ready to take on this challenge, and implementing many of the policies in this bill is the first step. Committing to decarbonizing the electricity sector will benefit all of us. It will create local jobs, save households money, and ensure a healthier, safer Minnesota for current and future generations. It will also allow Minnesota to be a regional leader in addressing climate change. We're at a point in history where the decisions we make today will have a profound impact on the future of our state and our world. We urge all of you and all of our leaders to make decisions today that reflect that. And we look forward to continuing to work with you on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Stu Laurie, and then following Stu will be Rick Evans.
Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stu Laurie. I'm the incoming Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union, and just wanted to share a couple brief comments in support of provisions in the bill that would eliminate the contiguous county restriction in the community solar garden program. We feel this represents an opportunity for farmers, and I'll just share some brief thoughts from one of our members who I talked to earlier this week about these provisions. From his perspective, installing a community solar garden array in his property would be an opportunity to increase that on-farm income, diversify those income sources, and essentially put those 8 to 10 acres in a conservation project that guarantees that income for 25 years, and particularly in a time when farmers are under extreme financial stress. I think many of you probably saw, as was written up in the Strib and Minnesota Extension, reported that farm income is down to the lowest level since the 1980s now, with a median income across all farms of $26,000. So this represents an opportunity for farmers and would increase their opportunity to participate should they of course live within XL territory. So thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill and thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We got into a little bit of this conversation the other night when we were talking about some solar garden projects, and I wanted to better understand the contiguous county issue, and I think you brought it up, so I wasn't thinking about asking you this, but I think I was going to do that. I have a small section of my county that is an XL service territory. It's a small town and several miles around it, but the city of Spicer has XL, and pretty much everybody else in my area does not. What I'm trying to understand is this law change, or the change in the contiguous counties, is the idea for this to build solar farms, solar gardens in outstate Minnesota to serve customers in Hennepin County where there's no room, or is it to do the other? Help me understand what would be the purpose of the changing this rule, because community solar gardens means, I thought, communities that are nearby. Mm-hmm. Can you help me understand your approach to this and why you think this should be done?
Absolutely, yeah. And I can let others speak to the technicalities of the bill, but I can speak from my understanding and the perspective of our farmer members. But I think we look at it as an opportunity. So this would be, farmers would be allowed, if they live in XL service territory, to participate in the program and come together with members who live nearby to them, but also live within XL territory, but not within that immediate vicinity. So from our perspective, this is an opportunity for farmers to participate and install that array on their property and guarantee that income source.
Okay. I want to better understand that. I don't know. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. I don't know if that was the initial intent of this, and maybe that's why they have the change in this bill, because the word community maybe should be removed from the name of this then. But I was just kind of curious as to what the intent of that, and you helped me understand that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rick Evans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. Over the course of the last few weeks, we've testified on a lot of the bills that are the components of this bill, and so I'm not going to repeat. We supported some of the parts of the bill, and we opposed some of the other parts of the bill. So I'm not going to repeat that unless anybody has some additional questions on those. But I just want to maybe step up a level or two and talk broadly. As you all know, XL Energy has made the commitment to achieve an 80% reduction in our carbon emissions by 2030 and set a goal of achieving 100% elimination of carbon from our system by 2050. Another part of that commitment, which is important, is that we want to keep our bills from increasing under the rate of inflation. It's really critical to us, to our customers, to the state, to the cities that we serve, that we continue to keep our rates low in order to attract new businesses. As you all know, XL Energy serves an exclusive service territory. We can't expand by moving out into other new areas. We can only expand our business by attracting new people, new businesses, new homeowners, and what have you to our service territory. We do that in part by providing reliable service, by providing safe electric service, and by providing low-cost energy. The process of getting to 100% carbon-free by 2050 is already well underway. Over the last many months, we've been meeting with stakeholders in our resource planning process, collecting their ideas, their thoughts, their perspectives on how to get to this goal, and we are in the process well along in preparing our resource plan. Perhaps by as early as late April, we will have a preliminary report of our plan that you'll be able to look at and see what the steps are for achieving this, and then we will file the final our final proposal by July. That's only the beginning of the process by which the PUC, with a tremendous amount of public input, public testimony, and really a very public process, will help us get to a final conclusion, which will result in an order from the PUC in terms of what resources we have to reach. We currently believe we have in the regulatory process and in statutes all the tools that we need to accomplish this goal. This goal was set by our CEO before the legislature started to meet. It was done based on current law. We do think there are some things in this bill that will help us in that direction, and we've testified to some of those. Particularly, we enjoyed working with Representative Stevenson on the early forms of the Clean Energy First bill, and we think that there are some components of that which are going to be helpful to us in this regard. But there are other parts of the bill, as we've testified before, that we find to be not helpful. And so we come to this bill with some mixed feelings. We don't think we need anything in this bill to accomplish our goal. We see some helpful things, but we also see some things that get in the way. Finally, I just want to speak for on the behalf of public utilities and the public utility model in Minnesota, because sometimes I think we lose sight of something that's pretty important. I think I've said this before in this committee. Public utilities were set up in order to provide universal access to electricity to all of the residents of Minnesota, and to do it on a non-discriminatory basis, non-discriminatory pricing, so that everyone comes to the system on an equal basis and pays their fair share. As we've talked about in this bill, there are continuing policies that move us in another direction, where certain ratepayers, certain customers are favored over other customers. Certain customers end up paying more because of essentially services that are provided only to a few. We deliver clean, our goal is to deliver clean energy to all of our customers, and to do so with all of them paying a fair share, so that the solar energy we put on our system will be shared by all of our customers. The wind energy we put on our system will be shared by all of our customers. We think this bill moves some of those, moves that policy to, in some respects, in the wrong direction. But we look forward to continuing to work with the committee and the legislature as this bill moves forward in the process to help us achieve the goal that we've set for ourselves and the goal that, that you had set for us. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I sure hope somebody else is going to start asking questions around here, so I'm not the only one that's looking like an idiot, so I appreciate that. So, Mr. Evans, thank you for that. I want to maybe circle back, because you're one of the, I won't say smart guy to you, but I'll say one of the guys represents, I'm kidding. So anyway, for the folks that are actually, to the company that actually had the amazing goal to say we can maybe get there 100% carbon free and by 2050, I think it's a great goal, and I think that took a lot of boldness to do that. But as I learned with the SIP program here over the last 25 years in Minnesota, the first SIP projects were really actually sort of easy to get to. Finding low energy or more efficient energy appliances and things like that, we found our low-hanging fruit. I just know that when I see this bill coming through like this and taking it from 0 to 20% or 25% by 2025 and then maybe taking it to 40, I mean, that's, we're doing some really cool stuff here with this. To get that to the next level is going to be really tricky. And I think that I applaud any large company that wants to try to get there. That's great. I'm nervous that a mandate is not the right approach. You might have heard me earlier ask Mr. Eloff a question about, again, going in front of the PUC and asking the question about if you think this type of thing is going to cause great damage to ratepayers, and if you see this on the horizon, have you ever approach the PUC with this kind of a thing before in the past, and do you think this might be one of those? Yeah, I know you're looking in a crystal ball. I'm asking you to, and maybe you can't answer it. But is this something that might be something we should consider sometime, because this might be a serious issue to possible all ratepayers?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair and Representative Baker, I take your question to be addressing the SIP program.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair,
Representative Baker,
it was actually referring to the page 16.14, when the commission, when requested to modify or delay implementation of a standard, must be done, and again, according to Mr. Eloff, by a utility. That's where I was going. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members. You know, one of the things I think we testified about earlier is that we find troublesome in the bill is a mandate for 100% carbon free by 2050. And the reason we find that troublesome is because short of just building a bunch of nuclear plants, which no one's going to do, we don't know how to do that. We've set that as an aspirational goal. Our CEO thinks it's important that this is what we have on our mind as we start planning resources, but we also recognize that we're going to have to know some things that we don't know now before we can do that. And so you do run up, you know, in that case against the possibility that we will start approaching 2050. I'm pretty sure I will not be sitting here when that happens, but we will approach that and find we just can't do it, no matter how much the cost. There's also the concern that as we continue to incorporate more and more renewable energy, you know, this is a lot trickier than a lot of people think, because most of us don't think about it this way. But, you know, the more wind and the more solar you put on the system, which you have no control over when it's available, you start actually getting sometimes more energy than you need, and you actually end up with negative prices. You start paying people to not produce energy. And so none of that makes it impossible, but it makes it a lot trickier than I think a lot of people think about. And so we do work very closely with the Department of Commerce and with the Public Utilities Commission. This is a matter of great concern to them as well. We've never asked for an exemption from a mandate. We've been able to meet our mandates and exceed our mandates without driving costs to a point where we think that we are becoming uncompetitive. So if that happens, it's going to require us to go to the Public Utilities Commission, to the Department of Commerce, and ultimately, if the mandate is in law and there's not sufficient off-ramps, we'll have to come back to the legislature, and hopefully we'll be able to explain why we think the mandate is not achievable and not achievable at a reasonable cost, and hopefully we'll get public policymakers to agree.
Final question, Mr. Chairman. And I think, again, I want to make sure the audience and the members know here that I still just have a lot of concern because of what we just went through in Benson, Minnesota with the biomass plant. What we learned was that was an extremely high-priced energy that was made at the ideal earlier about it was going to be good for the environment, it was going to be cleaner, it was just going to be a trade-off of what we did with the nuclear spent rods that were in agreement with the Prairie Island project. I'm just concerned that, and again, eventually, we shut it down because it was so expensive. It was causing ratepayers far too much money for that. So the legislation had to make action. We had to do that, unfortunately, in my community, we took a lot of losses on that in Benson. I just hope that we don't let that happen again. I hope that we see this coming, and before the train leaves the station, I just hope that we are strong enough to approach our PUC folks that have to interpret what we do here, and they have to make hard decisions, and I hope it's based on affordability as well as all the other stuff that we've been hearing today. So I'm just nervous because of the biomass example I've had. Thank you.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just kind of going back, we talked a little bit about the off-ramp and the ability to go to the PUC. Has XL Energy ever approached the PUC on that particular issue to be able to utilize that tool if you felt prices were going too high?
Mr. Chair and members, no, we've not had to use an off-ramp. The renewable energy standard that's in current law, we've been able to meet and I think actually exceed without having to resort to that.
Mr. Chair, Swazinski. You know, I've heard, you know, MISO come before the Senate panel and talk a little bit about the reliability of the grid. Obviously, that should be a concern of all of ours. It sounds like they kind of have a percentage of what they feel could be capable. Do you know what those numbers are by any chance, or could you speak to that at all? Or is there anyone from MISO here?
I don't see any MISO baseball caps in the audience. Mr. Evans.
If you want to know, there better be someone from MISO here because I don't know.
Okay. I think it's like 40%.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, sorry. So I think, you know, when we're putting these things forward, you know, when the professionals of the field are saying, you know, what potential grid issues that we could create, know, these are big ones, folks, and you know, this is serious business. And you know, I'm very concerned by a number of provisions in this bill.
Mr. Chair, maybe just to be somewhat helpful, you know, to make the committee aware, and I'm sure many of you know this already, if not all of you, you know, we file a resource plan every 2 or 3 years as ordered by the commission. And a resource plan typically is a 15-year forward look. And we're looking both at the amount of energy we think our customers are going to demand from us, which obviously has variables including conservation and how many people are going to move into the area and how many people are going to move out of the area, what's the economy going to do, go up or down, all of those kinds of things will impact that. And then also looking forward to what's the best way to provide that energy. And best way includes not only reliable and clean, but also very much the cost. And so, you know, the smarter people that are smarter than Mr. Underdahl and I sit down with computers and they run thousands of runs assuming, you know, or change, you know, what's the price of gas going to be? What's the price of wind going to be? What's the economy going to do up or down and all that sort of thing? So this is a big part of what already goes on in a resource plan. And, of course, predicting 15 years in the future is not an exact science, but we see the things that are developing as they develop, and the PUC looks very closely at this, as does the Department of Commerce, the Attorney General's office, as well as all the other stakeholders that get involved in this resource planning. So your concerns are very real. Your concerns are very legitimate. We do look very closely at this as we do this resource planning.
Representative Szczesinski.
Mr. Chair, to Mr. Evans, when you put those resource plans, are those public documents?
Mr. Chair, yeah, absolutely. What we file will be a public document, and as I said, that's just the beginning of the process. Then any person in the state of Minnesota or from outside the state of Minnesota can come and intervene, become a party. They can file testimony. They can file documents. They can file information. So this is a very robust public process that occurs in front of the Public Utilities Commission, and will take at least a year worth of testimony and research and study in order to, before we come to a conclusion.
Representative Szczesinski.
Yes, Mr. Chair, when will your next resource plan be published?
We are preparing it right now. A preliminary report might be out as early as late April. Our filing due date for the PUC is in July.
Thank you. And so part of that, Mr. Chair, part of that is when you're making that is, you know, understanding what you think cost of a resource is. So let's just throw a scenario out for you. Let's say in your cost estimate for your solar exploration, you spoke the other night in room 400 that you thought you'd do thousands upon thousands of acres worth of solar. And are you planning in your resource plan, so let's say this bill potentially move forward, that they, you know, the non-contiguous counties and all the rest, because we've seen your resource plan that you were going to maybe put solar in, and unbeknownst to you, you've had an outside folks come in and install it at 4 or 5 times your cost. You know, what are your estimates on your resource plan that you will release this summer? And you know, you're maybe quoting yourself as maybe 3, 3.5, 4 cents to have a resource come in and put it in at 12 to 15, essentially kicking your cheap out for something much more expensive. What do you think the likelihood of that would be?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair and members, you know, one of our concerns with the Community Solar Garden Program is it does come in outside of the resource plan process. We have no ability to turn that energy away. So if the policy stays, you know, something like what it is or even what it is in this bill, where we would expect to see it actually increase, you know, we expect to see hundreds of megawatts of community solar garden come on the system at a timing that we will not be able to choose and in an amount we will not be able to choose. And so what I expect will happen is that a certain amount of solar energy will be planned for our system that will be based on, you know, all of the factors that go into choosing solar energy, including the cost. But we also know that some of it is going to come in through the Community Solar Gardens program, and that we have to take, so we'll take that first. And then if we still have a need for solar, ability to build more solar, we'll build utility-scale solar or bid, you know, have other companies build it for us, and we'll buy their energy. So I mean, it is one of our criticisms of the community garden program is that it does come on the system without any recourse by the Public Utilities Commission or us or anyone else to say, you know what, it's too much, it's too expensive, it doesn't fit the plan. So we have to plan around it, essentially.
Representative Baker.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And continuing that conversation about the resource plan, how much currently of the solar garden energy that you are required to purchase is on your grid now? Can you give me like a 1%, 5%? Do you know what that is roughly?
Mr. Chair and members, I believe it's just a little shy of 2% right now.
Representative Baker. To that, Mr. Chair. And as I heard just your conversation with Representative Swazinski is that is not part of your resource plan. You don't know how much is really coming in the next 15 years when you put together a plan for 15 years. You do know the value of solar, at least the ratio that is. Is this something, do you think, and I know this is our job to do this, but I'm just wondering, in your opinion, do you think that we should have that part of the resource plan that you present to the PUC?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair and members, you know, we think the solar garden program should be controlled. We would like to see it come in through the resource plan. We would like to see a limit placed on the amount of solar gardens that are coming in so we would at least know how much. And, of course, we'll know the price because the price is set by the value of solar. So that, you know, that would be what we have advocated. We had many conversations with Representative Long on that and, you know, give and take and didn't prevail in his thinking in his bill. But that would be our preference.
Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Evans. Question I have is, you were talking about the 15-year plan, and then, I mean, you must have plans for every year, up to 15, always constantly adjusting with the way you're formulating where the energy is coming from. I understand that. What about price or rate hikes for customers? You indicated that's, you know, one of the bottom line most important things, which I respect a great deal. What sort of notification do you have on increase of rates, and is it like 1 year, 2 year, 3 year?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, you know, you're asking a complicated question. The resource plan is only one tool in the PUC's toolbox as they regulate our activity. So, for example, even a resource that is approved, most resources, if they're approved in a resource plan, we still have to go to the Public Utilities Commission when we decide to actually build it and get something called a certificate of need. So we have to demonstrate to them that we actually do still need this resource and we need it right now. And that's resource plan is kind of global, the whole system. A certificate of need is very specific. We do that for power lines, we do that for generation and that sort of thing. So that's a second process. In terms of rates, you know, we our rates are set by the PUC. We can't change them without going back to the PUC. And that's another, you know, extensive process of filing extensive budgets with the PUC and showing them what we think our costs are going to be. They evaluate those for reasonableness, prudence, and all of those other things. And only after, again, another long and very public process do they set a rate for us that we're then allowed to collect from our customers. And that rate is fixed there until we come back and ask for another rate case. So all of these things kind of work in conjunction, you know, to make sure that when we go build something, it's something that the regulators at the PUC as well as the company believe is the right thing to do, building it in the right way, that it's prudent, that it's reasonable, that we're getting the best price for it and all that sort of thing. And then there's a whole separate process after we've done that to work, though, to build that into our rates. So, for example, you know, if we were to add a resource that was approved through the resource plan and approved through a certificate of need, but then, you know, we had cost overruns or we spent more money, then before those get included in our rates, we would have to go to the PUC and demonstrate that that was the prudent thing to do, that we did the right thing, and, you know, prices may have changed since it was approved and that sort of thing. But that's all part of this. And I'm not a regulatory lawyer. I could bring people in here and I'm happy to come and visit you in your office. We could go into as much detail as you want. But it's a very extensive public process with a tremendous amount of detail before any of that actually occurs.
Mr. Chairman, Thank you. That helps a great deal, and I would like to talk more with you about it at some point in the near future. But that gives me a little window into that issue, and that's sort of what Representative Baker was talking about as far as how close are we to the edge on having catastrophic price increases for consumers. And so since I have never worked with the PUC or on, and I'm way newer than you at this, but I just, that helps a great deal. Another question I have is, your company Xcel has gone, you know, to endorsing the 100%, and it was mentioned it is very bold, and I know that, and I feel that. But what else in the company's experience is driving them to believe that this is possible? Because just a bold statement on this, I mean, you're not complete nationwide, but you work elsewhere in the country and have a lot of experience, and there must be a vision based on actual experience of what you're doing now that you look at this and you say, yes, this is achievable. So what brings that positive energy to that?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to bring somebody come and talk to you in your office who has more understanding than I do. But,
okay. You
know, as we see the ability to incorporate intermittent energy, which is wind and solar, which is it comes when it's there and it's not when it's not there, we can't go get it. We now balance that with what we call dispatchable resources, things we can turn on and off. That is largely, the stuff that's in the money is largely natural gas, which fortunately is also less carbon intensive than burning coal. We also have the nuclear plants, which are carbon free, but they're harder to turn on and off. You don't turn a nuclear plant on and off, is what I'm told. Our expectation is that, first of all, the price of renewable will be coming down. We will become better at managing it, being able to predict it. I'll tell you, when I started with the company 17 years ago, our engineers told me we could get 5% wind on the system, and after that we couldn't manage it because wind goes up and down and we couldn't turn things on and off fast enough. In 17 years, we've learned enough about how to predict the wind and how to balance the wind that we now take, 30, 40, 50% of our energy from wind, and we know how to manage that. So it's a learning process, but that still doesn't get you to 100%. 100% is going to happen when we are able to store intermittent energy and dispatch it when we need it. That currently is perhaps not possible and certainly very expensive if it is possible. So we need to see advances in storage. And, it's entirely possible that sometime before 2050 we'll have to come back here to the legislature and say, you know what, the storage has just not developed as quickly as we expected it to. Our expectation is that's not going to happen. So.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so that's, I appreciate that answer. And last question, Mr. Evans, is so with that being said, are you comfortable with the bill as far as the off-ramps you see in your ability to come back and say, we can't quite do this, or we have to make some slight changes, or we can make these changes and control price increases at this point for our ratepayers?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think, we are reasonably comfortable. There are some aspects of the off-ramps which I think have created a higher hurdle to get over. I have some confidence that the Public Utilities Commission will be able to discern that. They've got some really smart people there as well. So I'm not as concerned about it, but I wouldn't say it's unconcerning. The PUC is going to have to deal with those new standards, and we're going to have to deal with those new standards. And, we think the current standards work just fine. Don't know why they need to be stiffened and, changes. As Senator Senjum says, change is good. You go first. I guess we're going to have to go first here. So.
Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of quick questions, if I could. I applaud your company's goal of 100% in time, and I'm curious, with that 100% goal, is nuclear and our large-scale hydro, are those both an important part of your toolbox that will allow you to hit that 100%?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, representatives, we do purchase large-scale hydro from Manitoba Hydro. We have some small hydro on our system, like the one you've all seen down at the St. Anthony Falls, but but that's not, you know, really a significant contributor to the system. We do have Manitoba Hydro. We'd like to continue to use Manitoba Hydro. We think that will, you know, that will help us a lot toward achieving that goal. The nuclear plants, you know, the licenses run out on the current plants in 2030, 2033, and 2034. They have all, by that time, they will all have existed for 60 years. They are eligible for relicensing, but we are expecting it might be expensive to relicense them, and so we're exploring that. That's part of the resource planning process, is exploring the possibility of relicensing and continuing that. But even in the best of all worlds, that would be another, or I shouldn't say best because people have different opinions about that, but in the most, you know, extensive example, would, if we put another 20 years on it, that still, you know, doesn't take them much past 2050. I don't think, I was going to say I don't think we're relying on the nuclear plants to get to 100 by 2050, but I'm probably not authorized or qualified to say that, so maybe I won't.
Representative Bowe. Thank you. So the new plants really are, the nuclear plants really are not at the end of their operational life. It's really more an issue of licensing and storage and issues from that standpoint.
Mr. Chair and members, that's going to be a question for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. You know, the nuclear plants, obviously, because of their nature, are, you know, very highly regulated on the federal level, and safety, of course, is number one. So a plant in the United States has never been licensed beyond 60 years. I believe there's one currently in application for a license beyond 60 years, but it has not happened before. So we're a little bit in uncharted territory. I mean, I'm told there's not one single bolt in the plant that was original because everything has been replaced over time as regulations change. But, you know, I don't know that the NRC is going to have to decide what the useful life of the plants are.
Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one last question. I keep hearing about community solar and that there's quite a bit higher cost for that power. And so is community solar helpful or is it actually harmful from a standpoint of cost being too high? And would it be easier for you and better for your company to have other options for solar for purchasing power instead of the community solar requirement?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair and members, we support having a community solar program. We think that there can be some added value to our customers with community solar. From a system point of view, I don't think it helps us at all. It adds costs. I will say I do still owe Representative Wagenius an answer to a question she asked last Thursday, which I'm working on community solar. And so I'm hoping by tomorrow or maybe Thursday I'll be able to share more information with all of you about the costs and how the community solar works. But you know, from a system point of view, we would rather add utility scale solar. It's cheaper, it's more efficient, it's easier for us to work with. But I don't want to say, you know, we want to eliminate the community solar garden program. There's some demand for it. We think we can accommodate a good program. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm feeling a little bit left out, so I have a couple quick questions of my own.
I'm not feeling left out, by the way.
So you're feeling well loved. What is the cheapest form of power that you can buy right now as a company?
Currently, Mr. Chair, currently the lowest rate is for wind.
And when do you think that solar will beat wind for being the cheapest form of energy?
Mr. Chair, I don't think anything, but my resource planning people tell me that by the early to mid-2020s, we would start to see solar beat wind in price.
And setting aside your Xcel's views on the bill for a moment, what does Xcel believe that it can get to 100% clean energy by 2050 affordably and reliably?
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, that's an aspirational goal. So it's a little hard of a question to answer because if you ask me how are we going to do it, I can't tell you, and I'll tell you we don't know. But it's what we, you know, in the way the business works, when the boss tells you this is what we're shooting for, then everything that we do between now and then is trying to achieve that goal. But I can't tell you we know how to do it because we don't.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. If the chair will come back. Oh, excuse me. Is there any other members of the public who wish to testify? Okay. Chair Wagenius, would you like to make any closing comments? Before that, Representative Baker has
And Mr. Chair, actually, I had a couple of questions for folks that had testified. I didn't know if that was, if I could. Could we just call a couple back for some questions if they're still in the audience? Is that fine? Is that
okay? If they're around and willing to
Very quick, questions. If you don't mind, yeah. And that would be great. I would like to actually ask, I want to catch his name here. I think it's Mr. Cartwright, the teacher who's here. Yeah, thank you. If you could come up, sir, that'd be great. And I was, and Mr. Chair, I was going to ask Mr. Rob Scott Hovland as well to come after that, and then I'm going to shut down, I think. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming back, Mr. Hovland. And thank you for being a teacher. You know, your story is great to hear, teaching kids about this cool new energy and the cool new way that we're doing this. My question to you as a teacher is, and I am sitting on an education policy committee for the first time this year, I've been very engaged in our local schools at home. I know what an impact you have on these kids. And I want to ask the question, because I never heard it from you said at the testifying table, how much do you talk about the real cost of this stuff too? So the other side of the coin about how amazing the technology is, but also do these kids understand, as we have in recent conversations here, about how the community solar gardens really work, and that other ratepayers have to sort of pick up the cost, and it does make some pricing change, and whether it's up, you know, whatever that is. As a teacher, because you have a super important role to play in the balance of your education you give them, how much of that, and can you enlighten me on that side of that conversation you have with your kids? Mr. Cartwright.
Chair and representatives, we're not trying to influence what they think. We're trying to give them all the information. We're trying to, you know, not vilify oil. We're trying to tell them, you know, this is what the system is right now. This is what the system could be when we add more renewable. We talk often about the costs, the infrastructure costs of renewable, and we look at the timetable for when those costs will be paid off. And then we let them decide, is this a good use of financial resources? And so, you know, we want to give them opportunities to think for themselves, not tell them how to think.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Baker.
And thank you for that. I hope other teachers hear you say that from college universities and everywhere else, because recently I've had young students, and I think we heard it today, Leah had a really good conversation, right? I think she was our first testifier today. And she's passionate about this. And I've had a young student in my office this morning talking about clean energy and how passionate they are. But what I'm worried about is they're not getting the information about the other side of it and how that fossil fuels and or our initial renewable energy plans weren't always great at the beginning, but now look at them today. We could not be the country we are without fossil fuels. We could not be the industrial nation we are without, even back then, the Rockefellers and the Standard Oil companies and all the things that they did back then, which was were so cutting edge. And today we look back at them and say, boy, they were great, but boy, weren't they dirty. And they were. Oh, my goodness. And we've learned so much since then. But we would never be what we are unless they were just trying to at least get the engines rolling. And I just wanted to advocate, say thank you, but also, and thank you for sharing both sides of that. And it's a big picture thing. So thank you. I just wanted to ask you that. So thank you so much for that.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming back, Mr. Cartwright.
Thank you.
And you also had a question.
Rob Scott Hovland, if I could, please, from Missouri River. And I did have one final question. I'm sorry, for the PUC. Mr. Chair.
Rob Scott Hovland with Missouri River.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for one more. You now, actually, and because you hit home for me, you now represent my utility more closely in Willmar. You are taking over some of our managing our energy services. You are overseeing our power plans and when to buy off the grid, when not to. I know your company is more integrated than ever with my old company that I used to be one of the commissioners of. Can you tell me, and I didn't want to interrupt you, and there was a lot of testifiers, but tell me what your concern is. In rural Minnesota, in my area, that as we start adding more and more of these renewables to our grid, maybe more community solar gardens, what do you think is going to happen to our integrated cost? And I know, again, I'm asking for the magic bulb, and you know, I just don't know that. Can you give me an idea of anything of your concerns as, again, a specialist and your company specializes in this stuff, especially in greater Minnesota? Do you have any idea what this might do if we go too far with renewables and some of the mandates you're seeing in this bill?
Mr. Scott Hovland.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Baker, you know, Missouri River does a five-year IRP process and an IRP plan to choose our least cost resources. And we have integrated renewables, we've integrated energy efficiency programs, and all of those programs have been structured to keep the costs as low as possible for all of our members. In order to, as we retire some systems and increase others, obviously we're going to have to keep some of our legacy systems for the reliabilities that, as utility companies, there is no, we have to be 100% reliable. I mean, that was one of the things that we had experienced during the polar vortex, is many of our resources and some that we could call on, we had a lot of dispatchable generation at hospitals, at member utilities. We literally put everything online to keep the lights on for everyone. So if we add more renewables on top of that and displace some of the others, I'm guessing the prices may creep up a little bit. How much? I'm not going to speculate and go down that road. But the two can work in concert, but how quickly and how where we move in that direction, I'm guessing that's where we're going to have to try to be.
Thank you. Thank you for coming back up. And then if I could just have somebody from the PUC come forward.
Is there somebody from the PUC who would like to testify? I see our Vice Chairman Lipschultz is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan Lipschultz, Vice Chair of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. I wouldn't say I'd like to testify, but I'm happy to answer any questions members might have.
Thank you for being willing. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Lipschultz, for being here tonight. I keep referring back to sort of the community solar garden questions that I've been learning about the last week or so, just regarding the whole overall, and I heard a lot of subscription information, who the developers are, where the money is, the value of solar. I've really learned a lot. And you are you are one of the members that helps decide how the resource plans are laid out, if they're accurate or if they're not, and how they rate their rates. As I've heard, and you've heard some of this today, Mr. Commissioner, I'm wondering if you can help me understand if you think, because I know you can't take positions, but I want to understand with our community solar gardens expanding now, possibly three times what it is, we're already at 500-600 megs, we may go to much more if this bill passes. Do you, from a commissioner standpoint, think that there's a sort of a magic number? I think I heard something around 2% now is part of the Xcel incoming energy that they're purchasing for this. At some point, do you think that that should be a little bit more open and transparent to the PUC to help make better decisions about their resource planning going forward? Because if this got to be 5 or 10%, that's going to be a pretty big number that they're not able to share with you what their real costs are going to be. So from your viewpoint, do you think the legislature should be looking at something sooner than later to make sure that you have that transparency to see how those are done and how they're spelled out and that kind of thing, if you wouldn't mind?
Vice Chair Lipschultz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, first of all, there's no magic number that I can see. And if I'm understanding your question, you're asking whether we should have more transparency or a transparent look into what the solar garden developers are charging their customers for the subscriptions they purchase. And right now, we really don't have any window into that. But if we were to have more insight into that, I don't know what we would do with it because we don't regulate them. And so we're in a position where we set a credit that customers of solar gardens get for the energy that they might otherwise be purchasing from the utility, and that is set based on the value of solar methodology adopted by the Department of Commerce. And that's what generates that $2.9 million that last December flowed through the fuel clause to customers. And so I don't know what we would really get as a regulator from knowing more about the subscription prices that developers charge their customers. The real issue for us as a regulator is how much of that, actually gets passed on to ratepayers to essentially pay the cost of the credit that goes along with solar gardens. If that helps answer your question.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, I think it does, and that is helpful. I just know that when Minnesota Power or Xcel Energy presents to you a resource plan, they have to tell you their cost. And right now, what I'm hearing Mr. Evans say tonight is he's having a hard time seeing what that cost is for the next 15 years or at least whatever, because he doesn't know how much is coming online. And so my question to you back is, do you think we should make that? Again, I don't know what you can answer and can't answer. But do you think that should be part of, as this program will continue to grow, how can they present to you a more clearer picture if they don't know what their costs are?
Vice Chair Lipschultz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, I don't want to tip the scales on an issue you're discussing, but I do want to try to answer your question, and I'll just answer it as a regulator who's been doing this on the commission for 5 years and who's practiced in this area for 25-plus years before. And I think from a public interest regulator standpoint, it's always good to have the planning process as comprehensive as possible so that you have all the resources considered in the mix together so you can sort out and choose the least cost, most effective, reliable resource combinations for the system. And as Mr. Evans said, the solar garden program is designed to operate essentially outside of that planning process, and there are reasons for that. There are policy reasons for that, and it's not my place to comment on that. But in answer to your question, from a regulator standpoint, ideally, it would be good to have all resources considered in a comprehensive forward-looking planning process so that we can sort out in a transparent way what the most appropriate resource combinations in the future are for the ratepayer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Vice Chair Lipschultz, since you're up here, just one question for you. So in a previous committee hearing, there was a statement made with regard to the PUC about the planning process and whether or not the PUC had required Xcel to not build utility-scale solar. There was a correction sent out, and I just wondered if you wanted to speak on the record from the PUC about your view about that planning process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I wanted to make clear was we did not tell Xcel Energy you can't build more utility-scale solar. But the modeling that the Department of Commerce presented to us showed that you can only add so much solar to a point where it's not economic to do so. And the Department of Commerce said, knowing that we're going to have about 600 megawatts of community solar garden energy on the system, all of the utility scale solar you were going to build might take you too far, and you might end up with more solar than is really economic under the modeling. And our response to that was you should have at least, I think it was 600 megawatts or 650 megawatts of solar on your system, and if you can build more on a utility scale economically, we want you to do that. So we didn't want to cap it. What we said is you should have at least 650 megawatts of solar on your system. We know, based on the modeling, that that's economic. But we also know that you're going to have about 600 megawatts of community solar garden energy on your system. And so we didn't then order another sort of 200 or 300 megawatts of utility-scale solar. We simply said, if you can do it, please do if it's economic. And in the next IRP, the next resource plan that Xcel is going to file in July, we'll obviously take another look at it. These plans are iterative. We're looking at them every 2 years, and the modeling changes, the economics change, and it may be economic to add another 500 megawatts of solar on a utility scale, notwithstanding the community solar garden energy on the system. We just don't know that, and we'll have to look at it.
Thank you. I think I'd already asked the public if there were any further testifiers, and there were not. So if Chair Wagenius would like to make any final closing comments before we adjourn.
Just a thanks for everybody who has testified and stayed so late in the evening. And I think we are ready for the next, ready for Thursday. Amendments due, if I remember correctly, at 3 o'clock tomorrow. And just want to confirm that with staff.
That is correct.
Okay.
Okay. The only last comment I'll make is that Representative Bo is hosting the freshman party tonight. So hopefully all the members will join Representative Bo for the festivities. And with that, thank you, members. We're adjourned.